Hello, 2024. On this episode, we are talking movie theater memories, why do audiences struggle with change, some of our dream movie and TV pairings, and movie sequels we just didn't need. Let's get on with the show. My name is Aaron Peterson. Joining me today are my fellow hosts, Amanda Sink, John Davenport, and Troy Heinrichs. They are throughout this episode. We are back full steam next week. This is actually our best of the previous year episode because we took a couple weeks off. So these are four of our most popular topics from 2023, and I hope you guys enjoy them. We're just going to go from one into another, into another, into another. And I hope you're enjoying our spinoff podcast, Inspired by a True Story, which is more of a true crime podcast with a movie bent, which means we take a movie that was inspired by a true story and break down the true life events of what that story is or was, and tell you ultimately what happened truthfully, detail by detail by detail. And then at the end of the episode, we compare the movie itself as to what kind of, how was the movie and how true were the events that we saw depicted in that movie versus how much was Hollywood magic. So that's Inspired by a True Story. It's our completely separate podcast. It's in your podcast feeds now if you haven't heard it. We've got a lot of great episodes on there. Catch Me If You Can's on there, American Hustle, Scream, which that story that inspired that is freaking horrible and also riveting. So it's a really good episode to listen to. And there's a bunch of other ones and all, as well as several that are on the way. So check that out. That's Inspired by a True Story. But we're going to get into this. You can always support us on Patreon. There's a ton of bonus content. We just dropped one more bonus episode on there. That's patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. That's patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. I can't speak, but I'm going to get right into this. Again, my hosts, John Davenport, Troy Heinrichs, and Amanda Sink are scattered throughout these four specific topics, which involve movie theater memories, the audience's struggle with change, dream movie and TV pairings, and movie sequels we just didn't need. These were all fun topics from last year, and I can't wait to come back next week, which we're going to be our whole awards, where we break down the best in movies and TV of the previous year, what we loved. And then the following week is our movie extravaganza, which is our most popular episode every single year, where we look at the entire slate of films for the remainder of 2024, what's to come, what's exciting, and what we can't wait to see. Let's get into it. We're going to start with movie theater memories. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Hope you enjoy this bonus recap episode. I don't know what the hell you call this, but we love it. I'm Aaron Peterson. Thanks for listening. Here you go. And with movie theaters kicking back into high gear, which they are, the box office is rebounding. Thank God we're getting back to where people, I am a big fan of going back to movie theaters. So we thought, let's have a conversation about our favorite experiences over the years in a movie theater. Not just recently, but like as a kid, a teen, whatever, and why they impacted you so much. So first off, what's your most prominent memory of seeing a movie in a theater as a kid? And John, I want you to go first because I know you grew up in Panama, so I don't know how many movies you got to see in a theater as a kid.
I didn't really get to see that many movies in the theater. I do remember there was one time one of the parents took us all to go see Top Gun in the theater, which was a lot of fun, but I don't remember that one nearly as clearly as I remember the one that sticks out the most, which was we were in the States on vacation. It was summer and a little movie called Gremlins was out, and we went and saw that in the theater. And I remember being so excited to go see it because I wanted to see cute little fuzzy monsters and I wanted to see scary monsters. And I thought it was a good idea. My older brother and I were so excited. My little sister, not so much. My older brother and I were actually like hiding our face from the screen when it was starting to get scarier and scarier. Meanwhile, my sister's sitting there laughing her ass off the entire time, enjoying the hell out of the movie. So it was a fun family experience, which, in the history of going to the movies, I can count on one hand how many times the whole family went to a movie like that.
Oh, that's the best time. I think the best time.
Yeah.
What about you, Trey? What's your most prominent memory of seeing a movie in a theater as a kid?
Yeah, it wasn't so much this happened in the theater, but coming out of the movie, it's been burned into my brain ever since, and it's very hard to go back and watch this film. And it's why I so love The Ride, at Universal when E.T. said my name.
Aww.
When I came out. But after we saw E.T., I was pretty young. I think I was 4 or maybe 5 years old. We came out of the theater and I was like inconsolable, like screaming for E.T. to come back. That I literally was like ripping out of my parents' arms, like trying to get to the back window of the car, because I seriously thought that like when he took off in the spaceship, like the movie was real. And like outside was the same as inside the theater. And I thought like E.T. was up in the sky and I'm like reaching for E.T. to come back. And it's like that's going to be ingrained in my brain forever. It's my first like my first memorable like going to the movie experience.
I remember being very, very, very young when that came out and going to my mom and just telling her, I think I love Gertie, because, you know, she was young. It was like my first probably little crush or whatever as a kid. And I just found her so adorable. And I would follow Drew Barrymore as a career as it went on and stuff. And it's like, oh, what a rough road she had. But love her. I've always loved her since that movie. But that one broke my heart. I rewatch it every few years and it still gets me.
Just not the extended edition version. That's a little weird.
Yeah. Oh man, I remember when he changed it and it was, you're talking about how they took the guns out and everything.
Well, and the E.T. floating in the bathtub and
yeah,
that didn't all the extra stuff that they added in.
Yeah, it didn't work. Didn't work. Should have left it alone.
No.
Should have left it alone. Agreed. My favorite memory as a kid is Indiana Jones is my favorite franchise by far, even more than so than Spider-Man. And when Temple of Doom came out, I said Temple of Dune. That'd be a nice crossover. Indiana Jones and the Temple of Dune.
Sure make it a lot more interesting.
I want to see that movie. But when Temple of Doom came out, my whole family went because I loved Raiders so much that, you know, I mean, I had an Indiana Jones hat, I had a fedora, I had all that. I was running around with a really crappy whip and causing a lot of neighborhood damage. So everybody knew how much I love that movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, how much I love that movie. So they all came with me to see Temple of Doom. And that was an amazing moment. From the second the movie opens and Anything Goes starts going up until like the last credit, I don't think I moved. I don't think I ate popcorn. I don't think I did anything except was fixated entirely on the screen. I was absolutely captivated. That movie is still my favorite movie theater memory of all time because it's just my whole family was there and they were there because of me. They wanted to see the movie, but they wanted to go because I was so excited to see it. And I don't think I've ever been that excited to see anything in my life. And contrary to what some people like to say now, I still feel that movie is fantastic. Memories maybe affect that. I don't know, but it's my favorite Indiana Jones movie. Not the best made, but my favorite.
Who are these people and what do I have to do to hurt them?
Oh, the people that don't like Temple of Doom. There's a lot of them, man.
Yeah.
Even Spielberg doesn't like it. He bitches about it.
Spielberg's wrong.
Yeah, I know. Right?
It's because it didn't have the comedy. That's why people don't like it.
I think it was too dark. They thought it was too dark, right? It was one of those movies where Indiana Jones shouldn't be that. I mean, he's bringing a kid around, which would probably be seen a whole different way in this day and age than it was in the 80s. I mean, it's like, well, what did you do? Did you kidnap a child? Where did this child come from? And why is he never mentioned again in any of the other movies? That was a prequel. Is he dead? What happened to Short Round? We never got that story, which I'm still waiting for, you know, Short Tales on Disney or something. Because Gay Kwan is back. Go ahead. Let's make that series happen. I'm excited. Hey,
What about as an adult? What's your prominent memory recently?
As an adult, probably the most. I mean, I feel like Endgame we've talked about so much in the show, so I'm going to skip that one. But Endgame is that was a great movie theater experience, just seeing that with a crowd. But I would say honestly, Jurassic Park. It's probably as an adult, and I was a very, very young adult, but I technically counted. But seeing dinosaurs on the screen that looked like dinosaurs, that was an amazing thing to see in a theater. Like, absolutely phenomenal to see. I mean, it blew my mind. As a very, very young adult, it blew my mind to see that on a movie screen in 1993. Took my breath away.
What about you, John?
I think in that same vein, as a young adult, I would say it would have to be The Phantom Menace is one of my favorite movie theater memories. Not the movie itself, but the process in which I got to go see it, which was I organized a huge group of my friends because that was a thing we used to do back then. And I went and I had friends at the movie theater that I would go see and be like, hey, hook me up. And they would totally hook me up. I would be paying for it, but they would still get me tickets way before they're allowed to really sell the tickets. And I'd still get tickets to things. And then they would, before they opened the theater up, I had friends who would let me and my friends get in first and pick out our seats. And just, well, number one, just the sheer fact that I used to be so much cooler.
I believe that
is a little bit frustrating because as an adult, I could never be pull off the kind of cool that I was where I just like snap my fingers and shit just happens. I don't know what happened or where I took that left turn. However, yeah, like I remember having to wait outside because one of my friends couldn't make it there on time. And he finally shows up because I have his ticket and I walk in and the movie had already started. And one of my friends is sitting next to my girlfriend at the time. And I go to sit where he's sitting and he's looking at me like I'm the a-hole. And I go, what are you doing? And he's like, well, I'm watching the movie. Why are you in my way? I'm like, cause you're sitting next to my girlfriend trying to talk to her doing the movie. And he goes, oh, this is your girlfriend. I'm like, yes.
Troy, what about you as an adult?
And I think this probably is why I take depression meds today. But, I had this one moment where we were watching Inside Out and I had, like, totally in my head made up this thing where Bing Bong was going to be the one that gets them back to command center, right? Ooh. And they're on that train and they're climbing up the thing.
That didn't work out.
And then Bing Bong obviously does not make it up to the top of the command center. And I, again, was inconsolable. My kids are like, I'm never going to the movie with Dad again.
It's like, kind of awesome.
Like, the guy had to come by with a mop afterwards because Dad was just, I mean, I must have had an imaginary friend when I was a kid and it unlocked some kind of memory or something. Mm-hmm. But I've never, like, projected a movie and, like, been so wrong and then have it be so tragic at the same time.
See, that brings up a good point. Is there any other movie where you guys have been kind of inconsolable or emotional? I will tell you, I'm a sucker for father some movies because my dad and I have a very complicated past. Great grandfather, wasn't a great father kind of thing. But when I saw Frequency, I've talked about this before, but as soon as you get to the ending, I'm still to this day, I'm just crying like an idiot. But in the movie theater, I was just bawling watching the end of that movie because it's very emotional. It's very much about a father and son reconnecting and then showing that their life is now all the memories that they have now. And I'm like, just all of that was like, that's how I felt the whole end of the movie in that movie theater. It was kind of soul crushing, but also just really, really full of hope, I guess, from my own personal situation.
I have the same sort of reaction to Big Fish. And the reason why I had that sort of reaction to Big Fish was because the whole time I'm watching the movie, I'm like, this is my mother.
Aww.
I'm watching a story. This is before she even passed, but you know, the whole time I'm watching it, I'm just thinking, this is my mother I'm watching on the screen. Somebody who has all these amazing stories, and she always had amazing stories to tell us. And they always had some sort of feeling behind them and or something fantastical about them. And it wasn't until after she passed, especially after she passed, my brother, my sister and I were standing together and we were looking at the people who had shown up for her memorial. And we had the exact same moment that not Hugh Grant. What's Kenobi's name?
Ewan McGregor.
He plays the young version of the father in that movie. I'm thinking anyhow,
Billy Crudup.
Billy Crudup, right. Or Billy Crudup's looking at the people who showed up to the wake and he's seeing all the truth in all the stories that the father was saying. And my brother and I especially had that exact moment to even to the point where nowadays when we refer to our mother to each other, we refer to her as Big Fish.
Aw, that's really sweet.
Yeah.
I mean, Wildcats, when Goldie Hawn wins at the end, it's moving. It's awesome.
Really? Did you see that in the theater?
You know,
I'm just kidding.
You know, you brought this up. You opened the door. I'm gonna go ahead and go through this. I can remember.
Remember, it's gotta be. I don't know why you had to have seen it in the movie theater. It can't be something you watch later at home.
Come on,
that's the whole point of the freaking movie
theater. We talked about this.
Well,
whole topic.
We talked about.
Don't care.
My real one.
All right, fine.
My real one was when we went with, I think it was 10 of us to The Last Jedi opening weekend. It was like the Friday afternoon, and to see 10 40 plus year old people just puddles when Luke dies.
Mm.
Like that, like to know that we've been through all of this, because most of us were born right as Star Wars came out. Like Star Wars was our life, right? Born in late 76, early 77, you know, like we've lived Star Wars. And so to get to that moment and see Luke die, it was just like, nobody talked to each other after the movie. It took a good 10 minutes before someone's like, hey, want to get good ice cream? So it was a bonding moment at that point.
Did you guys, speaking of Star Wars, I know, I think John mentioned earlier, by the way, the trailer for Phantom Menace was really cool to see in a theater. That was an experience.
It was cool.
But also, I remember seeing Empire Strikes Back in a movie theater. And that's the crazy part, is when you tell your kids or you tell your people today, and you know, you didn't have the internet. You didn't know that you're for sure getting that third movie and that Han Solo was going to make it. You know, spoilers weren't around, so you had no idea. So it really seemed like Han Solo is freaking dead. Like, he's dead. I'm never going to see Han Solo again. What kind of sons of bitches are running this movie? And it ends on such a dire, dark note. Like, there's no hope, really, at the end of that movie. That, I don't think you could have the same impact today. Because the internet would, you know, you would have an idea what was coming in two more years. You would have an idea of, you know, what they had planned for the future. So-and-so was already signed on for the next movie, that kind of thing. Like, all that stuff would already, the information is already out there. So you're not really impacted the same way we were back in the 80s when that happened. And I just remember, because when Return of the Jedi came out, I mean, people were lined around the block because they just wanted to see if Han Solo was somehow going to make it out of this. And how?
Oh, forget the 80s. I mean, in the 90s, it was still kind of difficult. Sure. And you still had those, you started to get those websites coming, but your internet sounded like,
and the internet, like, just internet happened to show up like. When Jar Jar Binks showed up.
Yeah. Oh, God.
We should have known then. Jar Jar was the harbinger.
We should have. But you, like, even, oh, God, I hate to say it, and it sounds like such a get the kids off my lawn nonsense, but I miss pre-internet movie theater experiences because I didn't know everything that was happening. You know, you could go into Sixth Sense and not know the truth about who Bruce Willis was, even though my mom figured it out 5 minutes in, and I'm still pissed about that because I took her to that movie and she had no idea about it, and I'd already seen it, and I'm like, huh, my mom always figures this shit out. You're never going to get this one, Mom. 5 minutes in. So he's dead? God damn it. How did you get that? Like, she got that because she's like, well, nobody's talking to him. Or nobody notices it. That doesn't make any sense. I'm like, okay, I just can't watch movies with you anymore. But like, and then you had all those movies that you would watch, you know, Fight Club. I remember seeing that in a theater and just being blown away by how that all connected. And there's so many other films where, you know, it just The Usual Suspects, stuff like that would all be ruined today. I think a lot of that stuff you would not be as surprised about today as you were when you saw them in a movie theater at the time.
Oh, I remember when we left Back to the Future in the movie theater, and it was the To Be Continued, mm-hmm. and you were like, this is awesome. Like, we're going to get another one. Like, was it next year? And it was so long before 2 came out that when 2 finally came out and you saw the, you know, trailer for it, like, I think it was probably during a Super Bowl or something. And it was just like, oh my gosh, it's out. And it was like trying to get seats and tickets because you had to like go to the actual theater and buy tickets at the theater. Oh, there was no internet, you know? And trying to get like the movie times and whatever on movie phone and 99 cents a minute and all that garbage. It's like that getting tickets to Back to the Future 2 is like trying to get tickets to a Taylor Swift concert.
That goes back to you just emphasizing like how cool I was to be able to go get tickets to the Phantom Menace the way I did, because, you know, people are probably going, what, you just pull up your phone, go to Fandango. We didn't have Fandango. We didn't have the phones. We didn't have these sort of things. You actually had to make connections.
And you had to be there early, or you weren't sitting where you wanted to sit.
That's right.
You couldn't roll in 20 minutes after the start time and still get the seat you wanted.
Phantom Menace for us was 6 a.m. It was 95 degrees that day. and we sat in line from 6 a.m. till 4 p.m.
Attaboy.
At 4 p.m., you bought your tickets for the midnight show. And the minute you bought your ticket, you got in another line and then waited in that line to be let in to get your seat.
Yep.
God, I miss midnight shows.
That all actually happened. And shit like that was going on from Phantom Menace all the way up until about, I would say...
Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, Dark Knight Rises. Mm-hmm. It was the last time I did anything like that for a movie. And then it just... I don't know if it's because there was an overabundance of theaters at some point, or I don't know if it's, I don't even know how it happened, but it just, nothing feels like that. It can be the biggest movie of the freaking year. It could be an Avengers Bones, the DC universe, and you don't have to worry about this sort of thing anymore.
Yeah.
You like talk about get off my lawn. Again, I had to deal with.
But Troy was talking about midnight showings too. I miss midnight showings so much, and that was definitely ruined by Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah,
except for two towers at midnight. The theater was so packed, and it was so hot in there.
Wasn't it awesome?
Like, it's still 1:30, awesome. You're falling asleep during Helm's Deep because you can't keep your eyes open because there's just it's just like, oh my god, it's so late.
You're surrounded by sweaty.
Oh
nerds.
No, that was never my problem. Yeah, that was never my problem. I had so much soda that my bladder was going to explode. That there's no way I can fall asleep.
Well, that too.
I loved it. John apparently did not like midnight showings, I guess, is the way I'm understanding it.
The midnight showings were great up until them. A certain point. There was like an age factor. Then it was like, okay, 9 o'clock would be better off.
Yeah, I went to them. I just had to like figure out. Well, that was back in the day when I didn't care if I functioned the next day or not on a Friday. Mm-hmm. Now there's no way you can bribe me to go to a midnight showing on a Thursday night. Hell no, oh, man. I got shit to do. Great.
I miss it so much. I miss those terribly, and I loved them because what you would get is you would have a miserable Friday, sure. But in the same token, I would just take a nap, man. I would figure that out ahead of time. But
hey, you took off of work. It was fine.
But
skip class.
But I would go there. I did it with my kids over and over. Like there was plenty of times where I probably shouldn't have. What a horrible parent. I remember going to see Dead Man's Chest, Pirates 2 with my daughter, and having people dressed up like Jack Sparrow all over the place was fantastic. And everybody's running like, ah, savvy. And you know, it's just like, I don't know why I sounded like a 40s cop noir, but that's how my pirates sound. But there's people all over dressing up, seeing the Lord of the Rings movies, and people were dressing up for that. And they're coming as their favorite hobbits and things like that. The Harry Potter movies, you know, trying to get to the midnight show and seeing the kids are excited. The parents are excited. Everybody's dressed like wizards and they've got their various sticks or whatever the hell. I wasn't a big fan of it, but my kids were, so I suffered. Midnight shows were, I freaking love midnight shows. I absolutely love them. And God, that's one thing I miss. And I know everybody's like, well, we got 7 o'clock on Thursday, which I love too, but it will never rival a midnight show for a real big fan event. And I feel very bad that so many people will never get to experience that because that was such a, even if you'd only did it once in a while, it could be such a great time. You know what it sucked though? Is if you went to a midnight screening of a movie you thought was going to be a big hit, and there's like four people there because you feel like a real dumbass. Like if you went to John Carter for a midnight show, you would feel really stupid.
Oh, no. John Carter was a good movie.
It's not a matter of that. It's
not for a midnight show.
Yeah, not for a midnight show. You got to have that audience energy. And right. If there's no audience, the energy is sadness.
Yeah.
All right. I get what you're saying. I just
Matrix 2, Matrix 3 at midnight was awesome.
I was just reminded of another movie theater experience, which was for Battlefield Earth.
Oh my God. Oh, I just burned my Friday for nothing.
Yeah. Well, you know, talking about burning your day for nothing. My buddy and I went to go get tickets for all of us to go see it one night. And then we were like, hey, it's noon. We got all day. Why don't we just go ahead and see it now? And then we'll just see it later again today, like tonight. It's going to be that great, that kind of great movie. And so, mind you, we bought the tickets. We bought the tickets for everybody, not just the two of us. And then we bought two tickets to go see at the time we were there. And we go in, we see the movie, and we walk out, and we exchange our tickets right away for the ones that everyone got for, it was a Norm Macdonald movie. I think, Dirty Work.
Oh, yeah.
And we saw that. We saw that with everybody instead.
Well, that would be fun. quite the change, but fun.
It was not. Everyone was like, okay, we're ready to go to the movies. They're like, yeah, about that. We bought the tickets. They wouldn't give us the money back for the tickets for that showing. So we're going to go see this Norm Macdonald movie instead.
See, I miss, and I know I shouldn't, because in this day and age, you know, you can go to any movie theater. You can get a ticket for any showing you want of any movie you want, and it's going to be fine. Where I remember just waiting in line for Batman, waiting in line for Return of the Jedi, waiting in line for all these monster hit movies. But you literally would get in line for the kids. Let me explain. You would get in line, and you might want to go to the 12 o'clock show, but you can't get in till the 4 o'clock show. Like, that's how it was back then, because there were not so many theaters. There's only a few. So if it was playing in your local theater, you're waiting in line until you finally get in. I saw Return of the Jedi. I think that was the third showing after I lined up for it. And it was worth it. You know, it made it more exciting.
Bought tickets at 2 o'clock, and the only show I could get was the 9 o'clock.
Yeah. It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. I missed 3D. I know 3D came back with Avatar, but I missed 3D in the 80s. Like Friday the 13th 3D, where me and my buddy are just like hiding behind the seats because Jason's throwing a freaking machete at us. And I'm like, ah, Jaws 3D, horrible movie. But that shark was attacking me. I could feel it. You know, Krull. Remember Krull?
Oh my gosh.
Krull was great. And you wash your mouth out about Jaws 3D. That's a great Jaws movie.
No, it's not.
Okay. I mean, it's got Dennis Quaid.
It's an experience. It's not a good movie.
Oh, so many experiences.
Dennis Quaid, Leah Thompson. Come on.
Yeah. I actually remember seeing DTS presentation in the theater in 96. Was Independence Day.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And seeing just that was like a whole new experience. I mean, like, we talk about the Shake Your Ass Theater now that the kids go to in the Dolby Atmos Prime Theater for AMC. But THX, man, that was shit.
That really got, once that audio just kicked in, and plus Will Smith just, I mean, that was him emerging as a star.
Yeah.
I mean, that was his movie. Yeah, that was a huge, and that was such a great, I mean, for people that watched V in the 80s, we were all like, is V a movie now? But for everybody else, it was all this buildup. I remember the advertising campaign that built up to that movie where they didn't show you anything until it was released, really.
Right.
Like, it wasn't like trailers today where you know the whole movie going in. I mean, you're just like, big discs. I think Mark Singer is going to show up at some point, or at least he should, because otherwise it feels like a ripoff. And then you go and see the movie and it's completely different.
And then just that opens up with that THX. Yeah. It was like, holy crap. What did we just walk into?
Oh, the sound.
But not THX. DTS. Sorry.
DTS.
THX. Yeah. THX was done with Empire, I believe it was. Yeah. Back in the mid 80s. DTS was the new format in 1996.
Oh my God. And I remember for Spider-Man, because I'm such a huge Spider-Man fan, I let my son skip school so I could take him to see the Spider-Man when it first came out, 2002. And, you know, we were both just in awe the entire movie. Like, you finally did it. You finally made a Spider-Man movie and you made it like real. And you guys remember who Uncle Ben is and all kinds of things you did right. Except for, why are the web shooters coming out of his skin? Why? That's just weird, but okay, I'll roll with it. Missed those times.
I also had a private screening of 10 Cloverfield Lane in an IMAX theater.
How'd you get
I went to an 11 o'clock a.m. showing, and I was the only one in the theater for that IMAX presentation. It was glorious. Sat in the perfect center.
That feels kind of sad, too. I mean, nobody wanted to see the movie or what?
I don't know. I know, because 10 Cloverfield Lane is the best. It's the best Cloverfield movie out of all of them.
Nobody knew what it was when it came out. It was a shocker, just because at the time, I think a couple of big movies were coming out. And then they were like, oh, by the way, here's this quiet sequel we've been working on and told nobody about. And yeah.
From a no-name actor. And not no name. I mean, if you're around the, you know, media production stuff like we are as podcasters, you knew who Dan Trachtenberg was. But the fact that this was Dan Trachtenberg's first directorial debut, and it was as good as it was. I mean, man, 10 Cloverfield Lane, so good.
Yeah, it really was. It was very, very good. Chunkin'
is amazing.
Very, very good. Those are some great memories. See, movie theaters matter to a lot of people, even if they don't matter to you. Unexpected dream pairings. So let's discuss some of our favorite unexpected pairings in film or TV, as well as Do we have any dream prospects? Things we would love to see. So, Troy, let's you kick it off. So what are some of your favorite unexpected pairings in film or TV? As in, two actors who you would not have pictured together, but totally won you over. And I swear to God, if it's just Lost in an Alias, I'm going to edit everything you say.
It started out that way, and then I was like, no, like I'm sure this is going to be kind of boring, so I went a different direction.
Okay.
So I have three that came to mind. The first was actually Elijah Wood and Luke Kirby in No Man of God, when they were the Ted Bundy and Bill. Yeah. Like, I never would have thought Luke Kirby would have played... First of all, I never thought Luke Kirby would have played a serious actor or a serious character like Ted Bundy. And then for the two of these people to do this type of material in the same room, and that's basically the entire movie, is the two of these people in the room together for the whole movie. I really thought the two of them played off each other really, really well. Was pleasantly surprised. From a television perspective, I never thought James Spader would ever act with a newbie. But obviously, Red and Liz from The Blacklist, completely...
You should be ashamed of yourself right now. This is as deep as you thought. You should be ashamed of yourself.
It is the pairing that should not have worked, but it did because of the way the story turned out. It was fantastic. But no, the real one is Tim Robbins and Martin Short teaming up in Nothing to Lose. That movie is so funny and so great. I'd love watching it over and over and over again.
Wow, I hate to break this to you, but it was not Martin Short.
Oh, was it Martin Short? Martin Lawrence.
My God. Dear God. My God. Sorry. That is so amazing. It goes nowhere.
Freudian slip.
Edit that one out. You can't call or write something you wrote down a Freudian slip.
I was looking at two different things when I did this all.
Oh, it's got a Martin in it.
Yeah. Martin Lawrence.
Okay. Right? I knew the movie. Yeah, I know who he is. I'm well aware. I'm concerned that maybe you don't, but go ahead.
Oh, Aaron's going to dine out on this for a long time.
That's it, buddy. Patreon people. You can exercise that shit off you
Screw
want.
Screw you.
Nope. Oh, no. This is staying in the show, goddammit.
That's gold.
Oh,
God. That is gold. Honest Tim mistakes Robbins happen and Martin, in podcasts, kids. They do all the
Tim
time.
Tim Robbins and Martin Lawrence in Nothing to Lose. Such a good movie.
Now I want to see that same movie with Martin Short in it. He's just doing dances and singing and having a great time.
Yeah, so two guys doing a heist movie is always fun.
Always fun. Absolutely. John, what about you? You have any favorite unexpected pairings that took you by surprise? I've got bunches, but
I have a classic that I want to bring up first, which is Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor in Hear No Evil, See No Evil. Those two just playing off each other. It's not the first movie they did together, but it is a great movie to watch that they did together. And just watching those two geniuses play off each other, and it sort of feels like they're from they are from completely different neighborhoods, mm-hmm. and completely different schools of acting and completely different schools of comedy, and the way they work together, it's as if you're watching best friends on screen, and I love it.
That's a good one. That's good. And also, it should be noted, definitely they've got White Streak, they've got they've got Silver Streak. We've got so many different movies throughout
there. Nobody picks on Aaron. They all pick on me, but they don't pick on Aaron. They can't get the damn movie right. I understand how it goes now. Whatever.
I corrected myself immediately.
It's Aaron's white privilege.
Oh, damn.
Oh,
damn. You can't even say anything against it, because then it's, you know what? Just more white privilege. That's what that is. No, but they were wonderful in every endeavor they did together. They were just very, very talented guys, and they played off each other very, very well. And I've never been really a huge Gene Wilder or Richard Pryor fan, like either one of them. I've just never been a huge fan of either one of them. But when you put them both together, for whatever reason, I feel like they click more. Kind of like Tim Robbins and Martin Short.
They would click well together if they ever worked together.
Tim Robbins and anyone who's short.
Tim Robbins will be on season 4 of Only Murders in the Building now. Just wait.
Boy, I loved when Tim Robbins and Martin Freeman were together. In the Shawshank Redemption. Sorry. Go ahead, John.
So another one that I want to bring up is Bruce Willis and Danny Aiello, Hudson Hawk. Again, something that I don't know why I don't think it should work, but because I think maybe it's the huge age difference between the two characters.
Oh, yeah.
But
it's good.
But or the two actors, but they feel like they've been best friends their entire lives. They feel like they play off each other in such a wonderful way that it just engages the movie even better. And I think that's part of the reason why that the whole breaking in and singing a song thing really just works is just that those two just light up the screen when they're together. So yeah, that's another good pairing that I think.
I love the concept of the movie is better than the movie. Let's be honest. I love the idea of everything, and it's a little weird. It's a lot of weird, but those two together, and when they're singing the song and timing the heist to the song, it's just, I think it's magical. And unfortunately, too many people hate that movie that shouldn't, because they shoot a dog through a window. And I think that's amazing.
Bunny bubble.
What else you got? You got anything else?
That's awesome. I think my last one that I want to bring up offhand is Mark Wahlberg and Will Ferrell in The Other Guys. Again, a pairing. And I don't know what these two were doing in a movie together. I don't think at this point Wahlberg had done a lot of straight up comedy, but he is able to keep up.
I don't know if Ted was before.
Yeah, just Ted.
I don't remember.
I think Ted was after it.
Okay.
But even then, he keeps up with Will Ferrell pretty well as playing the straight guy to Will Ferrell's crazy, crazy guy. But it's weird because they sort of trade off the whole being a straight or crazy person throughout the movie, mm-hmm. you know, and it just lands so well that I really appreciate it when they do the Father's Day movie or whatever it's called afterwards, too, because the pairing does just work well.
I'm loving Other Guys. When he's like just so obsessed with Will Ferrell's wife, and Will Ferrell's just constantly implying she's homely and ugly and da da da.
Oh yeah,
so funny.
It's like Will Ferrell read your book whenever he talked about his wife in that one.
Yeah, I think so. That's funny. And also same movie. How about Dwayne Johnson and Samuel L. Jackson? How about that pairing? That was pretty fantastic. With the exception,
I really want to see that movie too.
I do.
You know,
can't get that movie unless they do a prequel though. Cause splat.
Yeah. You know, the thing that would be great, so great about that movie is that whereas Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg feel like they're the fish out of the water kind of thing in their movie, it would be the exact opposite, where it's these two guys living in an action movie, but the world's not an action movie.
Oh yeah, for sure. So good. I would love to see that movie. I freaking love that. And I still think their death is one of the funniest things I can remember in the last, 15 years or something. Like, I laughed so hard when they did that jump and just splat on the road. Like, I laughed so hard. I guffawed, if you will. I laughed so hard. All right. Well, here's some of mine that really caught me by surprise. Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis. Because in Thelma and Louise, I knew the casting going in, and, you know, I've loved Susan Sarandon forever, since Rocky Horror. I mean, I just think she's a very wonderful actress. And I just, the whole idea, these two are going to play, Butch and Sundance? That's what they're going to do here? They're going to do the female version of Butch and Sundance, which is essentially what it ends up being. But it was so well done, and they totally approached it from a female perspective instead of, you know, just making it a dude's movie with women in it. Like, it's a woman's movie. It's definitely, it's their story. And those two really just gelled off each other so well and made an instant classic, I think, and took me completely by surprise with how good it was. And also introduced Brad Pitt without a shirt. So does that count? Should.
100%.
It counts for a lot of people. I don't know if it counts for me in particular, but it counts for a lot of people.
John Travolta and Sam Jackson were from Pulp Fiction.
Yes.
I knew John Travolta, but keep in mind, I grew up with him from Welcome Back, Cotter, and Look Who's Talking. So to me, the idea of John Travolta being in this new crime drama was like, okay. And Samuel L. Jackson was really kind of a character actor at that point, and I think Loaded Weapon was before then. So I didn't really.
Yeah, it was.
There was nothing I was impressed by him in. You know, I was just like, okay. I mean, so there's nothing about that that excited me. They are probably one of the best duos in film and of all time. And it's because they also did Basic together. I think it was Basic that they did together.
They did do Basic mm-hmm. together. They're not together on screen very much in Basic, but they did do Basic together.
Yeah. And they just in Pulp Fiction, I mean, everybody knows, I mean, the movie's fantastic and it's a large part of that is because of those two and how they riff off each other. I mean, there's a large portion of the movie where it's just them talking and it's just back and forth, you know, Royale with cheese and, you know, is a foot massage okay? And just all these things. And yes, I know Tarantino writes great dialogue, but you need actors that really bounce off each other well for that. And those two, they were perfectly aligned because they seem like great friends throughout the movie, but there is a moment where it does seem like Samuel L. Jackson would shoot him in the face because of how he handled things. Like, and you really believed in those moments. And I think you need really two actors that feed off each other well for that moment to really work. And it did.
Yeah. And the thing that people don't realize is that this is the movie that remade John Travolta for everybody. Mm-hmm. And this is the movie that made Samuel L. Jackson for everybody. You know, again, he was a bit actor. The thing that you'll be surprised where Spike you see Lee him pop up
here and there, but
yeah, he was in some Spike Lee movies, but also he was in Amos and Andy, which was him and Nicolas Cage, which didn't have the same sort of punch to it that you think it would because Nicolas Cage is there. But he was also in Loaded Weapon that you mentioned. He was the robber in Coming to America.
Yeah.
You know, not a lot of great things to his repertoire. He was kind of at that point Hollywood glue where he showed up in the background of a bunch of different places, but he wasn't the guy. And this is the movie
that
turned
him
into the guy.
Yeah, he was that guy. And it made him the guy.
Yeah. Yep.
Then he became the guy.
And so there you go. That's another one. And then a pairing that surprised me and still to this day surprises me. I knew Jeff Daniels as an actor. Jeff Daniels was a kind of a serious actor. I never saw Jeff Daniels do anything funny whatsoever. And then he shows up with Jim Carrey and Dumb and Dumber. And I'm like, what the hell is this? Like Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels, that's your pairing for this movie. He's going to play a dumb. And he was so good at being an idiot, an absolute idiot. And I never saw that coming. And those two playing off each other as well as they do, I was stunned. To this day, I'm still stunned.
You know, you say you're stunned, and I have to really concur with that. It was something that was another one of those great moments. Like Jim Carrey had already become a name by this point, but to see the two of them on screen to make this movie, and it just blows your mind what they're able to pull off, and it's incredible. And Jeff Daniels again, just he didn't try to be another Jim Carrey. He just tried to be his own doofus of a character, and it works.
Yeah, and I've got a couple others, so I'm going to go through them, and I don't care. Dan Aykroyd and Tom Hanks in Dragnet is one of the most surprising pairings.
God, yes.
Because yes. I never expected that to work. And that's back when Tom Hanks was just funny. Like, he just did funny. He wasn't really doing the dramatic fare that he does now or curmudgeonly funny. He was just freaking funny. And he's basically a 12-year-old playing against the most stoic character in film and TV history as Dan Aykroyd's character. And they just play off each other wonderful. And like Dan Aykroyd does not miss a beat. He is the driest he's ever been in his entire career in that movie. And Tom Hanks is like the puppy.
You can't even ring him out.
No, you can't. And Tom Hanks is like a puppy just bouncing around. He's like a new puppy showing up to an old guy's house. He's just bouncing around him left and right. Ding, 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 ding. And it works. I love that movie. And I was so mad they never made another one because those two I thought were magic together. Their song, City of Crime, is just a joy.
I'm actually glad that they never made a sequel to that movie because there's just no way they could ever do that again. You got to remember, this was the 80s. In the 80s, if they would have made a sequel, they would have leaned harder on things that were dumb and forgotten about the things that worked. And it just wouldn't have had the same feel. And or they would have because there'd be a reason why Dan Aykroyd wouldn't come back, or there'd be a reason why Tom Hanks wouldn't come back. So they would replace them with some other gnome-named doofus that just can't pull off the kind of magic those two did.
I love that movie. I'm serious. City of Crime. Go find the video. I love that song, and it's Dan Aykroyd and Tom Hanks rapping. It's It's wonderful.
Uh-huh. This is how Chet became life.
My last one, which surprised me, was Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal and When Harry Met Sally. I get Meg Ryan. She's, you know, romantic comedy gold. Billy Crystal, not that. So when that came out and everybody was raving about it, I'm like, I don't have any, I don't want to see Billy Crystal as a romantic whatever. I mean, he's just not that guy. And it's not like when Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks are together, because you can always see Tom Hanks as a romantic hero. Billy Crystal, I don't know why, but I just don't. Probably because he's kind of like a little too smarmy and sarcastic-y, and you just don't picture it.
Kind of nebbish.
Yeah, a little bit. Of, yeah. And, it, yeah, and in that movie, yeah, he's kind of a dick through a large part of it. And he's a dick. But they play off each other wonderful. And by the end of the movie, all you want is for those two to get together. That's all you want in the world. Well, normal people. I don't know about John, because apparently he's hesitating. He doesn't know, but.
Well, yeah, I like, you just talked about how he's this nebbish, smarmy jerk off, but you're like, you know, they deserve each other. No, they don't.
He grew as a person.
He starts out the thing as a smart ass, basically, and he's just trying to prove a point, and he stays friends with her to prove a point. Well, that they can't be friends.
His point's not way off. Like, I'm just saying, like, yeah, there is. I'm sorry, ladies, but that guy you think is just your friend, he's probably thought about it a few times. I'm just sorry.
The girls thought about it too. Don't get me wrong.
I know I have.
I don't put thoughts into other people's heads unless they're dudes. Not my place. All right. Any pairings that seem like they should have been amazing, but just completely blew it for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Gene Hackman and Dan Aykroyd in Loose Cannons.
Oh, God. God, that was bad.
That was so bad.
And I love both of those guys. You're right. That should have been great.
Yeah. It should have been like comedy gold or even stoic gold. One or the other. It just should have been like the two meetings of the minds, and it just did not work at all.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I feel like I've seen that movie, but I can't remember
it's
it
like they're all. Both cops, but Dan Aykroyd is a loose cannon, hence the title. And he's manic, and he's got mental health issues, and they don't treat mental health with much respect, to be perfectly honest. But it was Grace. Fun. It's supposed to be
it was
fun.
The 80s.
Yeah, 90s, 80s, 90s, one of those. But Gene Hackman
was still kicking around, probably closer to the 80s.
Yeah, probably. I think it was late 80s. But I mean, they're both great actors. Like, I'm sorry, I know Dan Aykroyd never gets the credit he deserves, but, and I'll never understand it for the life of me, because I think he's one of the best comedic legends in film history, and just does not get credit for it. But you know, him and Gene Hackman, you thought would be great, because Gene Hackman's one of the best actors in history. But that movie, I mean, that was a paycheck movie for Gene Hackman. He looked like he was waiting for the check to clear the whole movie.
Hmm.
Any other ones there, Troy?
I also put on here Natalie Portman and Hayden Christensen. Like, you thought this would work, and man, it just, no. Attack of the Clones is so painful to get through. Any scenes where they're together.
There's so little chemistry, it boggles my mind. Like, just so little chemistry. There's no chemistry. Three movies. You'd think by the,
two movies.
Yeah, you'd think by the third movie, there would be some semblance of chemistry. None. Nothing.
She was like, thank God I had twins, so I only had to have sex with them once.
Shit. I still want to know how they look the same age, when obviously in the first movie, they were quite far apart.
Time dilation, space. Naboo was very far away from wherever they had stuck Anakin. So Anakin aged faster than, you know, whatever. And then James Vanderbeek and Katie Holmes, when Dawson's Creek came out, you thought like, oh, here's the bright-eyed, blonde-haired kid, you know, seems fairly normal. You know, here you got the, you know, kind of angsty, cute-looking teen girl that's got, you know, the broken home situation. And by the end of that first season, you're like, this is exactly why Pacey and Joey got together at the end of the show. Because it just, when they kiss at the end of the first season, you're just kind of like, ick.
Yeah.
Like, it just did not work at all.
It's good. So I've got three, and two of them are probably going to get me in movie jail. But one of them is a movie, probably, I don't even know if you guys have ever seen it. Michael J. Fox and James Woods and The Hard Way. Did you guys ever see that?
Mm. Yes.
That's another one of those movies that I think I saw, and I just don't remember anything about it.
Well, it's James Woods, a cop, and Michael J. Fox is an actor trying to learn to be a cop. And it should be great because James Woods was in his prime. So was Michael J. Fox. And it just, it's clunky all the way. It just never gels.
And that's what's them, but the story itself was an issue. Yeah. I think in that one.
Sure. Sure. But I don't think they ever really landed either. The next one.
Now that you hummed me a few bars of it, I know I saw this. I still don't remember a thing about this.
Well, go find it and rewatch it. This one is kind of, I know everybody loves this movie. I think they suck together in this one. It's just, it's my opinion, and I'm sorry, but it's my opinion. Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly in Step Brothers. I hate that movie. I hate how they play off each other in that movie. It just feels so forced, the entirety of that movie. I do not like it at all.
I agree that it feels forced the entirety of that movie. I am here for it, though. I love it. Everything about that movie. I think that was the first time I ever noticed Catherine Hahn.
Yeah.
And you know, just for that simple gift to human life, and being able to notice Catherine Hahn was enough to me to make that movie elevated to a great level for me in my heart.
I liked the pairing. I just did not like the movie.
Maybe it was the movie, but to me, I just did not. I love them in Talladega Nights. Like in Talladega Nights, I laughed the whole damn movie. I think they're freaking hysterical. But you've got this one,
like the
this one and the Sherlock Holmes one they did. Those were I think both those movies were atrocious.
I passed on the Sherlock Holmes one, but the thing about these two characters, so not even the actors, but the characters, I know these guys. They're Hal,
your friend.
They're my sweet, loving, adorable friend, Hal. And, you know, he's well into his 40s, still hasn't grown up, still, you know, just kind of drifting along and not really sure what to do with himself. So, yeah, I know these guys through and through. And I think it's one of the reasons why I love it so much, because I can see so much of him in there. If you're listening to this, Hal, this is not an insult in any way, shape, or form. If you're not Hal and you're listening to it, you know what I'm talking about.
Okay, my other one that I know is going to get me in movie jail, it's a movie I do not like it, and I know a lot of people love it, and it's very timely, you know, because it's right around this month that a lot of people will watch it. Groundhog Day. Bill Murray and Andy McDowell suck together. There's nothing about that relationship that works for me. There's no chemistry there. They're just, ugh.
The movie's great, but you're not wrong.
Hey, wait. So I win with the pairing, but you still love the movie?
No, the movie's awesome.
Okay. I don't like that movie.
I love the movie. But yeah, I always wondered, like, how did those two ever get together? Like, they don't even, like, look like they would date.
That's the whole point of the movie, isn't it? The whole point of the movie is to
It's like one person's from Woodstock and one person's from Winnetka. It just doesn't work.
Right. But that's the thing. That's the whole point of the movie, is to show how this guy ends up falling in love with her so much that he essentially decides to change himself to be the kind of person that he would, number one, makes him better entirely. So he's not some selfish prick, but also to be able to be ready for somebody like her, because she's so much more wholesome and so much better of a person. So that's one of the reasons I do love that kind of a story.
Doesn't come across in them. I'm sorry. That movie sucks. Say, like, it does not come across in that movie.
That's what they're trying to, like, get you to believe in, you know, from the romanticist, because it's like also like around Valentine's Day. But really, he's just taking advantage of a situation to get in a girl's pants.
Yes. Thank you. That's the whole freaking point of the movie. He's a pervert.
But he doesn't even sleep with her that night.
Not immediately.
No, they don't. He doesn't even sleep with her. Like
There's 47 of these nights. Which night are you referring to? Because eventually he does bang her.
Wait a minute. He uses that ability to bang every other woman in that town. I'm pretty sure there's some toothless old lady that he had a good time with. Like, all that happened. Like,
and somehow you got romanticism out of this. Like, he's making him a better guy. After I went through the entire town, after I worked my way through every single lady in the area, after I hit every bowling alley and 7-Eleven I could find, even the donut shops in the morning, I got every woman in town. But thankfully, there's one left.
I realized that this was the only one I really loved.
This is,
well, come no, on. There is a very sweet moment to it, because when he finally reaches that point where he gets essentially what he wants, he doesn't take advantage of it for the naughty side.
Fucking hero. Jesus.
All right, I will find a way to defend that movie no matter what. So
Ned Ryerson had more class.
Well, that's because he actually, yeah, you're right. He had all the class.
All right, John. Any that seemed to be amazing but completely blew it for you?
Yeah, so the first one on my list is going to be Channing Tatum and Mila Kunis for Jupiter Ascending.
I like that movie, ugh, but I don't disagree with you. I don't
know.
Yeah. You don't like the movie?
No. Because I think I didn't like the movie because of these two. Like, Kunis being cast in the first place, I thought was weird. And then to add Tatum, I was kind of like, what?
I find her wildly charming and engaging in anything I've ever seen her in. So this is the first time where I was just kind of like, okay, she just doesn't fit. She just doesn't fit whatever it is they're trying to say that she fits. It's not, there's just something about her that was off. And then Channing and her on screen together, it had some chemistry not to much. It, but like it didn't, but not much. It didn't, it just felt weird and off and forced. And I just, it was, and they're both like these great, amazing, charming actors, and it should have created this love bomb of charm, but it just doesn't happen.
Yeah, Channing Tatum had more chemistry with his body oil and Magic Mike than he did with Mila Kunis.
True statement.
I think I had more chemistry with his body oil and Magic Mike than
Mila Kunis. That doesn't make any sense, but okay.
What, like, he looked good all oiled up.
Oh, okay. I mean, I get that.
And I enjoyed it.
Okay. All right. That's all coming together. I think at least I understand where you're going.
Let me draw you a picture now.
I don't need a picture for that one.
All right. So my second pairing is Bruce Willis and Jai Courtney in A Good Day to Die Hard.
Sorry. Yeah. That's, God, that ruined Die Hard, the whole series for me for years.
It's the last movie of the series. Yeah. There's just absolutely nothing about that movie and that pairing that saved it. And the thing that's really sad is that I think since this movie, Jai Courtney has done some really good and engaging things. Yeah. Even his Terminator movie. Even him in his Terminator movie was bad, but him in the Terminator movie was the best I'd seen him. And then he follows that up with even better and better roles. So this was, he was very cardboard in this. He was,
So was Bruce, to be fair. So was Bruce.
Yeah, I was going to say he's trying to be another Bruce Willis, but the thing he doesn't realize is Bruce Willis is very cardboard in this. He's really just there for the paycheck. And I'm not going to beat up on Bruce Willis much more because we now realize that there's much more behind the scenes of what Bruce was dealing with. But, you know, it just didn't have it.
And it's his kid in the movie, and he's calling it every, he has to say his name 400 times. Like throughout the movie, John, 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 John. One of them is saying John at all times. And it's just like, enough. Just enough. I couldn't do it. And that movie is so bad. Their chemistry is bad. The movie's bad. Everything about that thing is bad.
Everybody about it doesn't work. And then my final pairing is something that I just think it's a bad pairing in general. So I don't know if there was going to be anything that works for this pairing, but it's Dean Hahn and Clara, you know, the Delevingne girl. What? Yeah, that one. And Valerian and the World of Tomorrow. Again, it's Luc Besson. You have these two actors who at the time seemed like they were going to be two great ideas for these actors. You have Luc Besson. I can't tell you how many of his movies that I absolutely enjoyed over the years. And it should have been something that just jumped off a screen and been different, especially the time frame where we were just starting to get into this oversaturation of comic book movies. I can't believe I just said that. I feel a little dirty.
Yeah, it's true. Although Kevin Feige recently just said, people are never going to get tired of superhero movies. I'm like, wrong, Kevin. You're helping.
Yeah, it's, you know, if you make quality ones, he's right, but come on. Anyhow, what I find interesting about this movie is that if you would have taken Dane DeHaan and Delevingne and replaced them with Channing Tatum and if you replace them with Channing Tatum and Mila Kunis, I think this would have been the better movie for those two to be paired up in.
Interesting. Okay.
Isn't it City of a Thousand Planets?
Whatever. World of Tomorrow, A Thousand Planets. It doesn't... because of these two actors, the movie's not good.
No, actually, John, the title does matter. It does. Just like Martin Short, Martin Lawrence. These things matter in the scheme of things. It's different.
That's what I was like, I'm trying to figure out, like, World of Tomorrow. Like, that doesn't make sense. Wait. Like, I swear this is not in the trilogy.
Well, maybe I was just trying to give... Troy a break there for a second.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah,
I see.
Valerian, my point is still the City of a Thousand Planets. Yeah. 2017.
My point still stands.
Yeah, they're not good.
No, they're not good. Anything else? Are you good?
So bad, couldn't even remember the name of the movie.
Yeah, see, I actually looked it up too, and I still wrote it down wrong.
Wow, how does that even happen? Oh well, at least you had the right ethnicity. So let's go. Let's go to dream pairings, meaning actors that don't make sense, but you would love to see them play off each other in whatever kind of film or series you can think of. And I'll start like for reference. I would love to see, in a typical Sandler-esque kind of movie, Adam Sandler and Harrison Ford. I just feel like with Mr. Curmudgeon and how dry Harrison Ford is, and having to deal with Adam Sandler in his most ridiculous and insane, I think that would be really, really fun to watch, personally, as a big fan of both actors.
He comes at him with a water gun and shoots him, and he's like, see, I shot first.
God.
In that Adam Sandler kind of way.
I want him to yell at Harrison Ford in his crazy Adam Sandler way. I want him to do full Adam Sandler, just yelling at him, and then Harrison Ford just shaking him off like he means nothing. That's the kind of movie I want to see. Maybe playing his dad or something.
He kind of berates him for a while, and then he just kind of pulls out a gun and shoots him dead. Like in Raiders.
Yep.
Oh, you have another one? Go ahead.
I do. I would love to see, and I know that they play best friends and social media all the time, and they're going to be in a Deadpool movie, but Hugh Jackman and Ryan Reynolds in a gay romantic comedy.
That would be awesome.
That would actually fall under something that gets put up on Pornhub, I think, as opposed to in the theater, because I'm not entirely convinced those two aren't a gay romantic couple.
Well, then it shouldn't be an easy sell. Because here's the thing, is like people are always saying, you know, gay actors play gay and straight actors shouldn't play gay. And so I think what you don't ever see are really like an actual gay romantic comedy, like they were trying to make Bros into one and it just wasn't a good one. But with actors who are notoriously straight, but also are well beloved by the gay community, I think that would actually, you want to kind of like break through to a different demographic. I think that's the kind of movie that would do it.
I'd watch it.
Just an idea. What do you got, Troy?
I want to see Kristen Bell and Bill Murray team up. You got kind of the sarcasticness on the young side of Kristen Bell and the sarcasticness on the, you know, aged and seasoned side of Murray, but it'd be a father-daughter tale where they have to like road trip or connect or some kind of thing. And then there's like a tragedy at the end of the movie, like either, but it, I think in this case, I want her to be like sick, and that's how she reconnects with her dad. And then he has to like deal with the fact that she lost her once, and then he's got to lose her again. So you give Murray that like acting chops at the end of the movie kind of thing.
I would watch that. I mean, that would be a great pairing of the two. I don't know if you could get Bill Murray to lock down for a lead role for that long, but
you can't get him locked down for anything. You basically call a number, leave a voicemail, and he shows up or he doesn't.
Yeah. For Kristen Bell, I hope he would. I mean, you know, she's a delight.
Well, I did this assignment wrong.
So I'm shocked.
I'm still trying to.
I'm shocked. It's so difficult to read. What did you do wrong?
Well, I thought it was when you saying what are some dream pairings, like what are the ones that you thought were executed so great that it was dream worthy?
That was the first question. That was the beginning of the topic. And then we moved
on. You know what, man? I was working on trying to get this computer running.
Shut up. Everybody else can figure it out. You know what? We've given Troy a grief. Let's give John, read the fucking format before we start. Read it.
What are some before we start? That's great.
It is written kind of vaguely. I mean, I could understand how John could get there.
Stop it.
Yeah, meaning
you be ashamed of yourself. Yeah, he would be so happy if you get dragged under the coals for getting Martin Short wrong. And he would just be so happy about it. Don't you dare bail him out.
This is like
Amanda bragging about being late. It's not something to brag about. It's rude.
I'm not bragging about getting it wrong. I'm just saying, oh, I did this wrong.
Anybody you'd want to see together.
How about Eddie Murphy and Melissa McCarthy?
I feel like that would work.
Nah.
Anyway.
I want to go with like Tatum and somebody, but who would be a good...
Who would not pair well with Channing Tatum? What? Who would not pair well?
I have a feeling
with
John
Channing
just
Tatum.
Really likes Channing Tatum. That's what I really
feels
think.
Like it.
I just really want to talk about Channing Tatum. I'm really jealous apparently of that whole thing with Selma Hayek that's coming out soon. And
I am too.
Yeah, you know.
How about Jason Momoa and Gal Gadot in like a sexy spy thriller or a heist movie?
Jason Momoa versus Godzilla.
Shit.
Oh, you take wait, him out for a this
beer.
Is great.
You take him out for a beer and just cool. get hammered.
He would take him out for the beer. That's right. So Godzilla and the what was that that movie with?
If you think we have time for you to get the topic wrong and then give us 5 minutes for you to try to remember what the hell you're trying to think of, you are drunk on power. Jesus Christ!
Godzilla and the kaiju monster from what was that? Colossal.
How about Spider-Man and James Bond? Why don't we put those two together? Those are two dream actor pairings right there. I'd love that.
Oh.
Well, multiple people played James Bond and multiple people played Spider-Man.
Daniel Radcliffe and Tom Holland in a buddy comedy about getting taller. Huh?
No. This is the mark of a man who hasn't prepared. That's what I'm hearing. It's everything I'm hearing.
Hey, I got everything else right. I got a computer that's working right finally. I got most of the topic done.
Okay, well, how about some listener? Let's do some listener picks. Let's do that because they can get it right.
I can't wait to do listener
picks.
I
can't believe how they got the topic right when they were questioned about it. But anyway, whatever.
Yeah, but they like talking to you and I don't.
Andreas says, I would love to see Sigourney Weaver and Emily Blunt as mother and daughter in a Western defending their ranch.
Ooh.
I could buy that.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I already bought the tickets.
I would do, which who
as
who
long as Emily Blunt doesn't step on a nail with her bare foot. Because I was like, ooh, ah.
Why? I feel like you're just desperately trying to throw in the one reference you could think of off the top of your head.
I did. That's exactly what I did.
Oh my God.
It's ingrained in my brain.
Adam Schreiber says dream pair, Robert Downey Jr. and Jon Favreau in literally anything. Which they've already been paired, but I would like to see them kind of more in an equal billing kind of roles.
Yeah, I think that would be a lot of fun.
You can't see them in anything else now.
Yeah, you know what? Troy's right. They would always be Happy and Tony.
Yeah.
You think so?
Yeah.
You'd have to tone down Robert Downey Jr. so much, and I don't think you can do that without losing some of what makes him so great.
Okay. Well, I can't wait to, I don't know, see the next Martin Short movie. Shit, with Will Smith. Sorry. All right, share your thoughts on this episode or anything else in our Facebook group or on Twitter at @BuyPopcorn. Our site is thehollywoodoutsider.com. You can rate and subscribe on your preferred podcast app. And please go to Patreon, which is only on patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. That's patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. Okay, so we're back to change. I want to talk about why we struggle with changes to our favorite movies and TV shows. Game of Thrones changed something? Readers freak out. Last of Us expanded their game to focus on Bill and Frank? People lost it. Superman has trunks or doesn't have trunks? The world loses their mind. What is our issue? Troy, you seem to have a very thought out analysis on this, so why don't you lead?
Yeah, my biggest thing with this is that people that they come from a point of view of, I enjoyed the first iteration of this, and therefore nothing is ever going to change the way I felt about that. And I find it really interesting because, like, take Game of Thrones, for example. It's a book. There is no visuals in a book except the ones that are in your head. So, yes, where I watched Fellowship of the Ring and the white horses coming in the river as she's taking, you know, Frodo, right, to Rivendell. Like, what I envisioned in my head when I read that in the book was pretty close to what Jackson put on the screen. So I was super happy with it. But other people that might have visioned that differently in their head might be super upset by that because it wasn't like it was in the book. How was it in the book? It was just written text. So the people that say it's different than the book drive me crazy because there's no pictures. So when you transition mediums from book to television or even television to theater, you have different storytelling capabilities. You get to show more visually, so you don't need the written word to describe it. You can show more in depth and size and sound when it goes into the theater than you can from a TV version. And even a video game version is completely different because you are playing the video game. The Last of Us, you know, that comes up right now, is the whole video game you're playing. Well, most of the video game you're playing as Joel. So the only storytelling you can understand is the things that Joel can see. He's not going to see conversations that Tess has. He's not going to see conversations that Ellie has around the corner. He's not going to see conversations that Marlena has. So when you transition that to television, you're like, I can tell those stories now. Those changes are fine because I want the expandedness. I already saw the original story. Tell me more of the story. Just make sure you hit the points along the way. This week's episode of Last of Us is a perfect example. In the game, it takes place in Pittsburgh. This week, it takes place in Kansas City in the TV show. Am I mad about that? No, because the points that they showed are still the points from the game. It still got from A to B to C. It just was in Kansas City instead of Pittsburgh. So you have to understand the medium that you're being shown and understand that you have to make changes. Like everybody said, original Dune was terrible because they couldn't make at the time the ships to look like they are in the book, and they can't make the world look like it was in the book. Now, granted, Dune, the new movie, is the most probably closest to the book. It's boring as sin, but at least aesthetically, it looks good, right? So that's what happens sometimes, is like if you get too close to the source material, it doesn't become entertaining in that medium.
Why do you think we can't walk away from it? I mean, does anybody have you still have whatever it is you love, right? So let's... I'm trying to think.
I am super terrified. Like I'm really pleased so far with The Last of Us, but I am super terrified for what they're going to do to Horizon when it comes to Netflix, both the first game, Horizon Zero Dawn, and then Horizon Forbidden West. Like those two games are so interesting story-wise that you could go 1,000 different directions, and it can go so bad really quick, and it can go so awesomely as well. So yeah, I am terrified of what it's going to do. Am I going to hate watch the show? No, I'm going to watch the show and enjoy it for what it is. It's a different form of art, unless it completely sucks.
To sort of echo what Troy is saying is that there's a healthy way of doing this, and there's an unhealthy way of doing this. So if you're going into a Marvel movie and you're expecting to see the story that you read on a comic book, you made a mistake. If you are going into a Star Wars movie and you're expecting to see absolutely everything that you read in the comic books or in the series, then you made a mistake. However, the other side of it is that when you're consistently seeing pitfalls in process and in storytelling and in just no respect or regard for the fandom and or what was created for the fandom, then you can honestly see it. Let's take Star Wars, for example. Star Wars is something that I've talked about at length and maybe at nauseam, where they have completely ignored a whole universe. Now, do they have to really bring that whole universe into the stories? No, they really don't have to. But the thing that's really frustrating is they're trying to tell the story that was told in that universe, but they refuse to bring in any of the points that would have made it its own thing and much more interesting. In the books, you have a separate race of creatures that come into the galaxy, and they start taking over the galaxy left, right, and center, where it starts becoming this very scary, very real thing that you have to try to survive. And the Jedis are forced to learn how to use the Force as the Force, and not really whether or not the Force is light or dark, but that it's a tool that can be used to be able to move forward. It's not the Force that can be light or dark. It's the Jedi themselves. And what you start finding out is you start seeing Jedis use Force lightning, which has always been attributed to being dark things that dark Jedis only do. But there you have light Jedis who are using Force lightning to get the job done, because it's the only way that they can get the job done to save people, which is ultimately their goal. So again, I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole, because that just puts me into a weird group. But there is always a healthy way and an unhealthy way of doing it. Give room for people who didn't share your vision to create a vision that, in which everybody might be happy, but don't expect to see everything you want to see.
And let's be clear, the healthy way is a Star Wars show with Admiral Thrawn. That's the healthy way.
Sorry, it's not Admiral Thrawn. It's Grand Admiral Thrawn.
I'm sorry.
Freaking plebeian.
I don't know what just happened. You guys both sound like
total nerds. At least I didn't say Asuki or whatever the hell Aaron said the other week.
Asawaka!
Gesundheit.
Thank you. Look, here's what I really want to expand on this question, because I'm guilty of it as well. We get caught up in our nostalgia. We get caught up in things that we love for whatever reason, whether it be a book, whether it be a movie that's being remade, whether it be something where a sequel's being done, more like reboot, remake, that sort of thing. And people will just lambast the hell out of it if it's not very close to what they remember. And that's one where even I get confused as somebody who understands and appreciates nostalgia. On the same token, you already have that. Like, nobody is taking that away from you. Nobody is removing that from your memory. You know, so if they make something that takes characters that you know and makes it a little different, it's not affecting. I'm not saying you don't have a right to your opinion, and you know, I have strong feelings on this as well. But it doesn't mean that it's removing anything. So why are we so against anything different than what we already have gotten? That's a question I'm really like, it's a struggle I feel like every single fan has in some respect, where we have,
I think
everybody has
put that much. No, I'm sure they do, but I don't think people put that deep of thought into it. You know, ultimately we are selfish creatures and we want what we want. And if you don't give me the green thing in the green way that I want the green thing to be, then it's not going to make me happy. There are those of us who have the ability of saying, well, I already have the green thing. Let me see if this turquoise thing turns out to be just as good, if not better. It could be. Who knows? There's a lot of room in which you have to give things. But it goes back to also tribalism. There's a tribalism that goes into some of this, too, where you have people who insist that things can only be one way and that's it. And that's, again, something that I think plays into this a lot.
You have to be open to possibilities. Like, I saw the female version of the Ghostbusters. It's okay. I also saw Ghostbusters Afterlife and said, that's the movie that should have gotten made, because that movie is great, because it's endearing to what was originally the source material. And then you're able to watch that with your kids, and now the Ghostbusters generation carries on, right? Versus making something completely backdoor, like the female version.
Sure, but that's a good example. Okay, so the female Ghostbusters that came out, everyone trashed it. That's not what Ghostbusters is. Why? Why? You already have your Ghostbusters 1 and your Ghostbusters 2. And I liked the female Ghostbusters. I'm not going to apologize for it. I liked that movie. I enjoyed it. I think it's funny. Even Chris Hemsworth, who's ridiculous. I don't think it's any... It's more grounded, maybe, but it's also a different kind of humor than the original two movies. It's its own thing. It's not doing anything to trash the memory that people have of the first movie. But yet, everyone came after it like it insulted their grandmother. And that's just something, and I still to this day, I mean, that was years ago, and I still to this day do not understand the reaction that people had to that. I just do not, other than take the sexism, obviously is there. That's definitely a small percentage, I'm sure. But I talked to a lot of people, and I feel like a lot of people felt like it wasn't their Ghostbusters, and nobody could really articulate why that is, other than it's not Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd. And I guess they just wanted those guys back. They wanted a continuation of that world. But why? That's the kind of change I'm talking about. Like, people just would not accept it. They had to have what they already knew. They already knew. I think it has more to do with that, with it not being Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis and their roles, than it did the fact that they were female. And I know some people will cling to that, and I know some people, that's why they didn't like it. But I also think it's more about that, about them not being the original Ghostbusters, than it was anything else. It's
version
of change.
There's no tie to the other movies. It felt like it was like...
But it wasn't trying to be. It was trying to be its own thing. Like, why does it need to tie to the other movies? It's its own... It's Ghostbusters. It's a reimagining of the property. That's what I'm saying. Why couldn't, and you have the same problem. We all have this problem with something, right? We all do. I'm not trying to pick on you or anyone else. We all have this problem. And I just don't know, why do we get so stuck on it? Like, it's just a different thing. Why just don't, we don't have to go see it. Is it because we love it so much? We want it done the way we want it done.
Well, the other component in which I think you're missing is that this probably has happened and did happen way before the internet. The only difference is the internet at this point has given everyone a platform in which they can jump on.
I get that. I'm not saying, yeah, I understand that.
Yeah. And so I'm just saying that it is just so much more obvious now than it's ever been. Back then, it was easier to see that a lot of those people who were poo-pooing something because it's not theirs were a small minority. But the problem now is that small minority can keep on repeating themselves until they keep growing and growing and growing. And you know, all of a sudden, that small minority just becomes a shoutbox in which the only ones who can be right are them.
But what I'm saying, John, is I don't think it's what I'm talking about. I don't think it's a small minority. I think every single person listening and as a fan of film or television has at least one property they are very devout with. They firmly are against changes to it that aren't what they see as the natural extension of that property. And when they see creators doing something different with it, they naturally reject it. Or they refute it. They don't want anything to do with it. Now, maybe sometimes that opinion might change when they see it and they're like, all right, that won me over. But most of the time, I mean, you know, we've seen it time and time and time again. Ben Affleck got cast as Batman and the internet broke, you know, and that was a lot of people that felt that way. There's a lot of people that felt that way. So it happens all the time because we have this
Heath Ledger's Joker.
There's all kinds of scenarios that you could point to where this kind of thing has happened. And it's just, we get it in our head and we just can't change because we want something else. And I just don't know why can we not, we all claim, it's funny you bring up the internet. The internet claims to be the most open-minded people in the world. They aren't, because they're the first one to shut things down when they don't like it, right? That is not open-minded. Open-minded is open to anything and willing to listen. And then make an informed opinion. But we all have shut things down that we thought it's against what I believe. You know, I have very hard, fast beliefs on certain characters for certain reasons, and they are my reasons, but I have them. And everybody I know has them, whether they want to admit it or not.
Mine has been Star Wars, which the thing is about Star Wars that I can say is that I at least gave the movies a chance to disappoint me regularly. Over and over again, without fail, mm-hmm. And then it's Godzilla. So Godzilla 1998 or 1999. That movie, I gave it a chance to because when I originally saw the new design that the U.S. came up with Godzilla, I was like, that looks not great. But I still went to the movie and I still sat down and I still tried to enjoy myself until it became Jurassic Park. And it's a combination of tribalism to now also the ease of access to these shout boxes of, hey, all these people have the same exact opinion I do, and none of them have seen it either, and I'm just going to go here and enjoy sitting in this stink hole of garbage versus saying, all right, you know, Ghostbusters, it's got an all-female cast. Why don't we just see what they're going to do? And they create something that's great, has its own story, has its own beats to it, and it doesn't feel like the same movie. It has some of the same things that the original movie has, but it does a very strong job of doing its own thing.
I mean, like, Lord of the Rings is that way. And I think, like, when they said, hey, we're making Rings of Power, I'm like, that's awesome. It's continuing the story I know in the same universe with the same people, and it's going to bridge the tie. I think that's great. You come in and say, I'm going to make Lord of the Rings, but the hobbits are now giants. And I go, WTF, that's stupid.
Yeah, right. Well, see, the thing about the Lord of the Rings, the first movies. Okay, so you look at the first, the Lord of the Rings, and you go, okay, this is clearly created by somebody who has love and appreciation for the source material, and there are changes here, and we're okay with those changes here. Then you look at the Hobbit.
We're still against Tom Bombadil not being in the movie, for the record.
Okay,
for the record.
Missing the point. Now, then we go to The Hobbit, which they say, you've got the creator, the same guy again, saying, all right, I want to make two movies, no more than two movies. And then the company says, no, we need three. And he's like, no, this story is shorter than the other stories. We can do this story in maybe one, but more likely two movies. No, we still need three. And they throw in a bunch of stuff that they absolutely don't need, like the dwarf elf love triangle. We don't need that.
The entire third movie.
Yeah.
The entire third movie.
Mm-hmm. Except for the battle.
Except for the battle.
Which you could have gotten in if you got rid of the dwarf elf love triangle thing.
Yeah. Should have been.
And the really bad CGI. The really bad CGI.
So let's talk about, all right, at a time where, and I mean, you really change your mind on something beloved to you. I mean, I'll give you one just to kind of start the ball rolling. And I really thought deep about this. With all the dream casting of Idris Elba, people used to talk about, I used to have this very strong opinion that James Bond shouldn't be a person of color because the character in the books, which I read as a kid, he's quite clearly written a white guy with black hair and cold gray blue eyes. That's literally how the character is written. It's very detailed in many of the books. So to me, I was always of the mindset, just create another spy with a different number. No big deal. But I've come to realize with this and many other characters, if the race isn't integral to the character, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter. Even if it was written that way, it doesn't really matter. Changing sex, I would still say, create a new character or just give a female the 007 moniker like they did in No Time to Die, because he is very clearly a man and it is inherent to his character of James Bond. But race doesn't matter with James Bond. And, you know, it's something that I had to get over as... because I was an avid book reader and I love the character and I love the whole world and stuff. And I'm like, well, no, he's a white guy. Why are you changing it? Are you just changing it to change it? You know, and I had to come to that realization myself, and I did. And I'm just wish I would have came to it sooner.
I mean, you're talking about Idris Elba, The Dark Tower from Stephen King. I mean, when you know, Roland Duchesne of Gilead, you're just like, he's a cowboy West 1970s white guy, you know? And then when they say Idris Elba is going to play Roland in the Dark Tower movie, not a great movie.
But he was great. He was great.
He was great. As like, I could not see anybody but him playing Roland going forward. So yeah, the color has nothing to do with the character. The character is a character.
But you know what's sad about that? Is if you try to have that like a real conversation, by God, don't do it on the internet. Because people just jump on, well, it's a racial component, so therefore you're racist or da-da-da-da. No. That's actually a nuanced topic that we're actually having a real conversation of evolution on, and you just dilute it because you can't have a real conversation about it. That's the problem with the internet. We're having a real one here, but you can't have that on the internet.
And it's going to happen with Little Mermaid when Little Mermaid comes out.
Oh, God. I'm sure it will. That poor girl. I mean, I'm sure she's ready for it, I hope.
I'm not looking forward to that at all. Well, not because of the character or anything. I'm not looking forward to
the conversation.
Shitstorm.
Yep.
Yeah. The shitstorm.
Yeah. The shitstorm that's going to follow that.
I mean, the underwater sequence, the trailer. I mean, all of it looks great.
I hope she blows I hope she blows the water out of the theater. I just hope she knocks everybody's socks off. And what argument do you have now? What argument do you have?
Yeah.
You know, because don't get me wrong, there are cases where it's just people being racist. I absolutely understand that. But I'm saying we're having an actual nuanced conversation about something that has layers to it. Unfortunately, I feel like the internet just can't do that anymore. And I'm saying the internet as a collective.
That was the case with the third episode of Last of Us, right, John? Like those people that were saying, oh, it's different than the game. It's like, it's not because it was different from the game. It's because you're homophobic. That's why you're upset with it.
It's the exact same thing in which, you know, if you were a fan of Schitt's Creek and loved the love stories you saw on that, and there were people who were fans of Schitt's Creek, but they kind of threw their arms up at that same kind of love story. They handled it in the same exact way. It was a love story for the sake of love stories, and it was a beautiful story being told. And I don't care if you know, there's two tab A's there or two slot B's. It doesn't matter. It still does a very heartwarming job of telling a beautiful story.
It was a beautiful story.
I wanted to go back to how people's thinking are a little off on this. You talk about the character that Idris Elba's playing in the Dark Tower, how he's supposed to be a cowboy. In the books, he's a white guy and all that other stuff. The first cowboys were not white guys.
Great.
It makes more sense, honestly, to have Idris Elba playing the character. So, I don't know. You want to go more historically accurate? That's great. It works, and well, I appreciate it.
I think he was talking about in the book. I mean, it's a fictional book, so I don't even... But
well, no, it's a fictional book, but I'm just saying how... it goes back to like the argument people have about why it can't be... Idris Elba.
He's a black cowboy. I get what you're saying. Yeah.
Right, exactly. That's the argument. So something that changed my mind that was surprising to me. So I've talked about my love for the Dresden Files novels and how much they have brought a lot of joy and excitement to my life. And they've turned me into a pretty big reader in my advanced age. And I do love those novels. Now, the reason why I got into the novels was because of a short-lived television show on Syfy or Sci-Fi Channel, depending on how you want to pronounce it. But it was a show based off the novels, and I really liked the show. I got into it. Paul Blackthorne as Harry Dresden was awesome, and everything about that show was just good to me. And that's why I started reading the books. I watched the first season, and it turned out to be the only season. I wanted to live more in those stories, only to find out that after reading those books, the series is practically unwatchable for me. I have tried to sit down and watch the series, and I just get mad because every single time I watch it, I'm like, I'm watching it and I go, well, this is the story from this book. They just condensed it down to 45 minutes and they could have done so much better storytelling if they would have just like made the whole season the book.
So it sounds like you started with things that you had come to the agreement, you've changed your mind on, but now you're back to where you won't bend on them.
Well, technically,
Okay. All right. I feel like you made it more complicated. What are some things that you won't bend on? Like some characters, like you are just steadfast. I'll give you the one that comes to mind first. A long time ago on this very podcast, Justin McCumber, former host, I think it was episode 200, I think, where we had a big debate on Spider-Man sexuality. And Justin McCumber and I had an argument over whether Peter Parker could be gay in some iteration. We had a big debate about it. I was steadfast then. I'm steadfast now. That no, Peter Parker is a heterosexual, and it has decades of print from Marvel detailing that and his romances with Mary Jane and Gwen. I still believe that is the case to this day, and I don't believe we should be changing character traits like those just to appeal to a demographic. In my mind, when you start significantly changing defining character traits, because a lot of those relationships do define Peter Parker and his character and his evolution, and his romances with those women are very important to that evolving character, you are no longer honoring the character you say you love. So if you're going to do that, why not create a new character if that's what you're trying to do? That doesn't mean that there cannot nor should not be a gay Spider-Man or woman, whatever. I'm just saying not Peter Parker, because there are decades of stories that contradict that. What do you guys think? Go ahead. You can shoot me down if you want, internet.
Like Optimus Prime?
Careful.
Optimus Prime has to sound like Optimus Prime. If Optimus Prime sounds any other way other than Optimus Prime...
He has to be Peter Cullen.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has to be Peter Cullen doing the voice. I really like the dichotomy of this conversation at the moment, because Aaron comes in and he's all like, Peter Parker does not take. And you're all like... Well, as long as the big robot sounds like the big robot, I'm okay. I love this. And I'm on your side. Peter Parker needs to be Peter Cullen. It can't be anybody else. I'm with you.
Peter Parker needs to be Peter Cullen.
I'm sorry.
Spider-Man
you're right.
Just became like
Optimus Prime needs to be
roll out.
Optimus Prime needs to be Avengers Peter Cullen. Nobody else can do that. I think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing Optimus Primal in the next movie coming up, because God only knows we're going to lose Peter Cullen any day now. But I'm going to do the sign of the cross right now, but with the wrong hand, because the other hand's next to the microphone and I don't want to punch it. I did that for somebody. Anyhow, I'm with you.
Yeah, it would sound
way
different.
Way to think deep. Way to think deep, Troy. Way to think deep.
Well, I'm
really proud of you, Troy.
I'm not a comic book reader, so I don't have like that.
But he's always got to be Optimus. I hope they start cloning his voice pretty quick.
They just bought James Earl Jones's voice. He's always going to be Darth Vader. I mean, it's possible. Darth Vader would be one. Like,
I don't think Hasbro can't be anybody has Star but James Wars Earl money, Jones. Though.
I don't think they do either. The movie theater might, though.
Although, in fairness, Peter Cullen's no James Earl Jones.
This is true. All right, John, what about you? What do you stand fast on?
This is a hard one for me, because I feel like if I go to this well, I've mined this well for absolutely everything I can, but I'm going to have to go to this well. Luke Skywalker is not a cranky old man who decides to give up on the world. That's not who he ever was. And the fact
what about
that,
through evolution, through time, you got missing years and that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, at no point does Luke become anything less than trying to rebuild the Jedi world and trying to not be the only Jedi left out there. And he does not go and hide. He does not go in and become whatever it is. He doesn't go and milk weird creatures for blue milk. That doesn't happen. Like, he becomes a beacon of hope in the galaxy, and a hope in which other people who share his talents or share some sort of talent like him end up going to follow him so that they can become these protectors of the galaxy again. So this whole idea where he's just like, I'm going to go hard because I tried and then my nephew killed everybody. That doesn't happen.
But think about it from a Jedi perspective. Obi-Wan was training a young Padawan who decided to turn the wrong way and caused Obi-Wan to go flee and hide in the desert and live like a hermit. And then right. Luke Skywalker, who was trained by Obi-Wan, tried to train somebody else who turned on him and turned to the dark side. And so therefore he went out into a grassy land and lived as a hermit. So he only
right.
learned,
so
he just learned from his master.
Right. So he just control C, control V, Obi-Wan when they already saw that was a bad idea, where he was supposed to be the bringing back the great balance to the Force. If the great balance of the Force was to just quit when everybody decides to make it hard for him, then you don't deserve to be a Jedi, man.
So he's not bending on this, but it's over. He's dead now.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Because he reclaimed his Jedi-ness.
The 5 minutes in which he was amazing almost nowhere near makes up for the fact that he wasn't Luke Skywalker. Yeah, you can go ahead and think that sentence out. I go ahead, dare you.
Okay.
I mean, he's kind of a douche in Empire Strikes Back. He's like, I'm just gonna disregard everything you told me and I'm gonna go do what I want to do.
He was young.
He was young and dumb and full of force.
Super angry at parts of that fight when he was in the third movie. He always internally struggled with himself, no matter what it was.
Right. That's the curse of being a Skywalker, right. Is that internal struggle. Leia has the same internal struggle. So that was the curse of being a Skywalker. He wasn't infallible. He was never an infallible person, but he wasn't supposed to be the person who gives up and rolls over, which is the thing that I hated about those movies, was that he was the person that gives up and rolls over and controls C, control V's Obi-Wan's way, and then decides to go ahead and kill himself off or accidentally kill himself off. I don't know if he meant to do it or not, but he's just turns into dust in the middle, like when he's miles away. Granted, very cool the way he went, because all right, well, we're going to force project ourselves to someplace else and win a badass fight. All right. Again, that's not what Luke Skywalker was ever supposed to be. He was supposed to usher in the new Jedi Order, and in that new Jedi Order, a whole new set of nightmares that we can all deal with. Not just one nightmare, a whole new set of nightmares.
Hmm. Well, let's switch to what some of our listeners thought. Why they think people hate change so much. Josh Steima says, fan entitlement has a huge part to do with it. People become so attached to certain iterations of characters that nothing can ever top it for them. That is usually before the new property is even seen. I try to hold out until actually seeing it for myself on whether the change has been for the better. Optimism and pessimism are perfectly welcome with any decision on a property, but at least give it a fair shake before burning it down. I agree with that. Unfortunately, most people apparently do not.
I try to agree with that. Like I said before, I went into every movie that I had my doubts about and still gave him my money, and I left that movie either okay or even more angry. So it happens, and I try to do the best I can. It's part of the gig, is to do the best we can to be that way about it. So I do agree with him. My comment comes from Jason Faltenek.
Good job.
Yeah, I did it. I was putting it together in my head, and it sounds almost like he's a Transformer himself. We're asking the wrong question. The real question is, why are we rebooting so many things, many of which are already beloved? When there are enough content from bestseller lists that have never been made in the movies or TV to fill primetime lineups for years, I'm not mad necessarily because they've ditched the Trunks. I'm mad because the Battle of the Planets movie. Oh, I'm mad because I want the Battle of the Planets movie. I want that movie too. Or a movie based off half a dozen books and characters that I love. He's absolutely right. We have so much content out there in the world in which we can start creating stories from just about anything to tell new stories or fresher looks at stories that have been already been told, with different characters or whatnot. So I really like the idea of stop mining the thing that everyone knows, where we can do what we did with Harry Potter, where a few people knew the stories and loved the stories, and then they turned it into a movie series, and all of a sudden we made one author a gajillionaire. You can do this exact same thing to somebody else's life by taking their work, throwing it into the limelight, and creating a whole new fresh world that way.
2 points. One,
Amazon, do the Dark Tower.
Hang on.
Amazon,
2 points.
Do the Dark Tower.
2 points. They are doing the Dark Tower. Mike Flanagan's part of it.
Wow.
So 2 points. One,
supposedly.
The idea that we're remaking, rebooting, that's all we're doing. That's just not true. There's tons of original movies and TV shows out there, a lot of original movies, and people don't go see them because they are watching things that they know. That's my point number two. Why are we doing it? Because of name recognition. Because in a sea of 500 plus scripted shows every year and hundreds of movies every year, that stands out more when you have name recognition. That's why. So if people would take people that would stop saying, why are they rebooting everything, and would take more chances on original movies and properties, there would be more original properties. It's really a people problem. We create this problem. We, all of us listening, we're the reason why it happens. That's the answer to the question. It's our fault.
Oh, yeah. I do agree with that part. But I like the rest of his points.
Oh, I like this point. I'm just saying, whenever people tell me that's all that's out there, that's just not true. That is not true. It's not all just reboots and sequels and all that stuff. There are plenty of original things out there every single week. Hundreds of movies every year. TV shows all over the place. There's a lot of original content. People just go back to what they know.
I think it's because my time is precious and I don't want to take a chance on a flyer and be disappointed or get it canceled or be the OA.
Don't. Troy.
Troy, you have anything from a listener?
Yes. Carlos Martinez said, I used to listen to this terrible podcast where the host remade everything. Supposedly right. Anyway, they asked a very good question. Anyone looking to alter, update, reboot, remake a property should, but typically don't, ask themselves that, being, should we do this? Just because they can doesn't mean they should. It's one thing to do this with a little-known IP like Battlestar Galactica. Ronald Moore improved that universe drastically. Trying the same with an IP that's basically a household name is quite another feat. Look at the mess that is Star Wars. Star Wars. I like that. That's a fun play. So as long as the changer makes logical sense and it fits the lore canon and characters, I don't care. That's kind of my stance. Like, if you're expanding on the existing lore, it's fine. Rings of Power, fine. The new Emperor President Snow movie for the Hunger Games, fine. Like, those are stories in the universe. Let's tell them. It's interesting.
But just stop mining nostalgia. Like, don't remake Goonies.
Yeah, there's no reason to remake Goonies. Do the Goonies movie that we came up with on Remake This Movie Right, where it's they're older and it's their kids that are doing the thing.
People would watch it.
Aren't they making that one now?
No. I don't know. It's all nothing confirmed on what they're doing.
It's it's done. That's why I'm not giving into the Dark Tower until I actually see a trailer.
Fair enough. And the podcast he's talking about is Remake This Movie Right, and there's still 60 episodes out there in your podcast feeds if you want to check it out. It was a good show.
They're fabulous. Fabulous.
Good, fun show to do. All right. Well, share your thoughts on this episode or anything else in our Facebook group or on Twitter at @BuyPopcorn. Our website is TheHollywoodOutsider.com. You can find John's artwork on Insta and Twitter at @RJohnDraws. Amanda, if you can find her, she's on @SinkIntoThis. Troy is @TroyHeinrichs, and I am @AaronSmirks. Now in line with the topic this week, take a beloved property or character of yours and tell us how you would change that property or character to reach a completely demographic.
I don't know why I went this way, and I didn't take it as big of a property as I probably should have, but I thought this was going to be great. Let's take the show Doomsday Preppers, right? And instead of making it a show about people who are getting ready for a doomsday situation, let's do it like Hoarders, where we're dealing with people with some sort of mental illness and how we are working through that mental illness.
Hmm. I've never seen Doomsday Preppers. I don't even know what that is.
It's a show in which people are creating bomb shelters.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
Isn't it just Hoarders, but underground?
Technically.
Because they're hoarding toilet paper.
All right, Troy, what do you got?
That's interesting. I picked Survivor, longest running game show, almost close to The Price is Right. But they used to, like, in the early days, went to, like, different locations. Now they're just in Fiji all the time. So I want a version where they have to survive on the streets of a city. How do they survive? How do they survive the concrete jungle? Right? Uh-huh. And then the challenges are, like, scavenger hunts for a much-needed item or tool in order for them to actually survive on the streets.
Here we are. We just drop these 10 white people. These 10 white people from an affluent neighborhood in the middle of Skid Row with nothing but
the clothes on their back and the one item they brought. The clothes on their
back. Well, they'd be dead. I'd watch it, though. I would watch it. Bye-bye. See ya.
They live down in the subway tunnels with all the people down there.
Apparently, this whole topic, I thought way deeper than either one of you ever did. But I would remake Indiana Jones as either an African, an Asian, or a Hispanic man. Because Indiana Jones is my favorite character. And the reason being that we've already got the Harrison Ford versions. That's not going anywhere. So he kind of like traversed through history as a white man. I want to see numerous aspects of history through other cultures and historical items they might have worshipped, things like that. And I would love to see that brought to life through an archaeologist based on that historical record. Then that way I never lose the films that I've loved over the course of my life, but I'm exposed to different cultures and different history. And I think that's important. And it also would be a lot of fun.
I mean, obviously you could also do Short Round, because Short Round lends himself obviously to a spinoff with Kihi Kwan back in the limelight. I think it's a perfect time to do something like that, but you could also just do Indiana Jones that way.
I mean, and that's a way to teach kids history and get them interested to explore history of other cultures.
Yeah, definitely. That's one of the things that I've always liked about National Treasure in general, is because
guess what, guys? We have a Constitution. What? Yeah.
What?
Nick Cage stole it. Go read up. It's an important document.
What are these amendments thing? I only know one or two of them.
Why does it smell like lemon juice?
Right. Anyhow, like but the aspects of hearing these different stories for that are from history, or even the made up stories from history, is pretty cool. It's also why I liked Falling Skies so much, because Falling Skies, you have a history teacher teaching you about
how the US and how the world dealt with war in this scenario in which they're fighting aliens.
Until the final season. And then you were kind of like, where is this going?
Right.
Star Child.
Well, interesting conversation.
Went totally V on it.
Totally V.
I love V. I miss V so much.
The first two seasons are great, though.
Oh, you're talking about the new one?
I don't give a shit. Falling Skies.
No, he's talking about Falling Skies.
Oh, they're talking about V.
Nobody would ever make that mistake about the V's TV series. Let's talk about a hard line against something.
Just saying.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm like, that new TV series sucked. What are you talking about? That was not good. I like Marina Baccarin, but
Nope. I was going to say, we were watching it for Elizabeth Mitchell and Marina. That's the only reason we were watching it.
Yeah, and even that wasn't enough. I couldn't keep going with it. I'm like, nope. I'm going to go watch the 80s versions again for the 15th time.
Only the 15th time? You got to get those numbers up.
Well, do we count Independence Day? Because we should.
That was great.
I wonder what Mark Singer's doing now.
I don't know, looking grizzled as all hell.
I think Home Depot gives him a break.
Wow.
Speaking of the Meg 2, let's talk about sequels we didn't need. The Meg 2 is out, and as much as I enjoyed the first one, and I kind of enjoyed the second one, we didn't really need it. We didn't need another one. Based on the box office, like Troy was talking about earlier, I think we can all agree on that as well. So many movies get sequels just because they did well, and we obviously didn't need all of them. So I just want to talk about sequels that came and went and why you wish they hadn't. So I want to know, first off, John, when do you need a sequel? When do you need a sequel to something?
Oh, for me, I need a sequel for something when the characters are just so well created that I want to spend more time with them, that I want to see the furthering adventures of that character. Or on the flip side of it, if there's a hint to a backstory in which there's an ability to see where they came from, that so we're talking prequel, but technically it is still a sequel, like the whole prequel idea, it really, whatever. Anyhow, like it, essentially for me, sequels are important when you have characters that you want to spend more time with ultimately.
Yeah, we're not talking about prequels. I don't need to know how John McClane became John McClane. We're talking about what he did after he saved all of those people. And
I think prequels count as sequels because it's the second thing that came after the first thing.
I mean, I guess wouldn't have, technically.
The second thing wouldn't have happened if the first thing hadn't happened.
Right. I mean, we only call them prequels because they happened before the movie, but they're technically sequels because of the order in which they're released.
Feels like a technicality. All right. So what about you, Trey? When do you need a sequel?
I think when you get to the end of the movie and the hero has like the hero moment and then the anti-hero is still out there. So I think in like Alita Battle Angel, like that one clearly screamed like, where's part two? Because you're at the point where he's about to ascend into the sky and you're like, come on. Or like The Matrix where you're like, yeah, he might have beat this one person, but now that he's beat this one person, like what other things are out there? Because Neo is just so badass. You know, that's when you're like, I definitely want a second movie. Or when you get like where it's like set up to be a movie for a sequel, like Back to the Future, like Roads, where we're going, we don't need Roads. And it's like, oh, yeah, going to the future. Let's go.
Literally says to be continued.
It does. You know, so movies that are like that, where they have a clear setup for a future possibility. I think those are ones that are ripe to say, like, we could do a sequel if we get the time.
Yeah, for me, it's all about the end of the movie. How much I want to know what happened to the main characters. I remember seeing a good example is The Mummy. You know, I was dying to see Rick and Evie again just because I adored them together and they were fun to watch. And I didn't expect that going into a Mummy movie. I expected to, you know, really just care about what The Mummy was doing. Ended up caring more about the characters than I did The Mummy. Literally, they could have made the next movie without a mummy and still called it The Mummy Returns. And I still would have wanted to see it.
Yeah, absolutely. Because those characters are endearing and, mm-hmm. and wonderful on screen together. Rick and Evie had so much great chemistry. And even Jonathan had great chemistry with the two of them.
Sure. And then you go to the third movie and you've got like Walmart Evie and it just doesn't work.
Oh. It just Maria Bello is Walmart, that's hurtful. Evie. Walmart, but yeah, you're right. Evie. You're right.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm just saying that's hurtful. You're also right.
It doesn't necessarily have to be the characters either. It could be story concepts. So don't want to give anything away with Hijack, but like I don't need a second season of Hijack, but there's concepts in Hijack that are definitely worth exploring further.
All right, so let's talk about some examples of sequels that you were excited for, but once you got them, suddenly you wish it was just the one film.
So the ones that I keep on coming back to, The Legend of Zorro, the sequel to...
You didn't like the sequel?
No, I did not like the sequel at all. There was just something missing. There was something missing about the second one. There was, I really enjoyed the first one for the buildup and for the relationship between, Anthony Hopkins' character, who's wearing brown face, I guess, the whole time.
Kinda, he never got called out for it, but he sure did.
Yeah, he sure was. You know, there was a lot of great moments with those characters, and it just didn't seem to hit the same way for me. Men in Black 3, I needed to stop after Men in Black 2.
That needed to stop after Man in Black 1, sir.
I like the third one, but I get the second one, but I get it. I'm with you. And The Chronicles of Riddick was not the movie that I was expecting.
You didn't like Chronicles of Riddick?
No.
I loved all three of the Riddick movies. I have no problems with any of them.
I like the first one and I like the third one. The second one, I just felt like they were trying to make it too epic, and I think that's where for me the problem was, is that it didn't need to be an epic story. The whole story of this guy surviving situations was good enough for me.
Yeah, I mean, for you, but I like the idea of expanding the story and making this absolute jackass who's a complete loner and doesn't care about anybody become controller of this entire world. I thought that was an awesome twist, man. I dug that.
Well,
it's fun.
You may have liked that, but in this third movie, they took it all away from him.
Didn't care. Still got the second movie. You got to enjoy it, man. I dug all three of those movies. And it's funny because Pitch Black, I hated the movie the first time I saw it, except I loved that character. And then I went back and rewatched it. I ended up liking the movie. It's one of those rare occurrences where it won me over after multiple viewings.
Right. Finally, Boondock Saints 2 was one that I was looking forward to.
That's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. It missed the mark pretty hard, especially with Sean Patrick Flannery's new face. It really bothered me.
Jesus, it's cold, man. He's not Mickey Rourke.
He's getting there.
I think he fights too. I think he fights a lot too. That's probably where it came from. How about The Matrix?
So head damage?
Troy, you just talked about The Matrix, and that's my prime example. I wanted that sequel so bad, and then once I got the sequels, I just wanted them to fade from my memory. And I never want to see them again.
Yeah, it's up there.
And the first one, you were talking about how, like, at the end, you couldn't wait for the next thing and everything else. But now that I've really kind of torn myself away from any of those sequels, I watched the first one. I think it ends perfect.
It does. I'm the superhero. I own this place.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's a good moment at the end where you can just be like, all right, I'm done. The second and third ones were a mess, because that's another one to me where they said, okay, well, now we need to make this story even more epic, and they missed the mark with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Speed, I think, is the obvious one. No Keanu, don't make a movie. You know what I mean?
Right.
But I did want that. I wanted a sequel bad, and I even went and saw it because I got excited for it.
Yeah, Sandra and Keanu working together, it was magical.
Yeah. They're wonderful together. Man, Jason Patrick and Sandra, though, not so much.
Mm-mm. I was just about to say, put Sandra with anybody, and they got great chemistry. But Jason Patrick, on the other hand, has negative chemistry.
Yes. So
it actually makes Sandra unlikable.
Right.
The most energy he's ever had was in Lost Boys. And he didn't.
Oh, that's not saying much.
That's what I'm saying.
That's not saying much.
He just looks like morose the whole movie there. That's just who he is. You know, he's just not a energetic actor.
I think the only movie where his energy matched the movie perfectly was Rush.
Yeah. And everybody raved about that role. Oh, he's so good in Rush. Yeah. You know what he's not good in? Fun movies. He just isn't fun. And then there's a couple of Stakeout 2. I love the first Stakeout. This is very 80s, but Richard Dreyfuss and Emilio Estevez, I think, were a wonderful team. That first Stakeout is one of my favorite, like, 80 buddy comedies. And then they made a sequel, and I was so excited for it. It's kind of like another 48 hours, same kind of thing, right? I couldn't wait for a sequel, and then I got it, and all I wanted was to forget about it.
It's because of Rosie O'Donnell and the dog, isn't it?
She did. Yeah, she ruined it, for sure. She was not entertaining. And another 48 hours, I don't know how that one went so south, because there's no way an Eddie Murphy movie in the 80s with full R rating should have not been good, but it was kind of like Coming to America too. And another since we're talking about it, Eddie Murphy, Beverly Hills Cop 3, one of the worst sequels of all time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Gives theme parks a bad name, and I worked at Six Flags.
It really did. And that score, that was such a horrible, horrible score. I just don't understand. You have Axel Foley, the theme, and you have the first two movie scores, which are, you know, and a lot of soundtrack, great soundtracks and everything else. And then you get Beverly Hills Cop 3, and it sounds like a, like, it's almost like you're trying to recreate the theme park vibe by having like a kid friendly score, and it's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
What about you, Troy? Once you were excited for, but once you got him, you said, oh.
I mean, we talked about it already. Back to the Future 2. Like, yeah. Everybody wanted that movie. And then, oh my gosh, what happened? Bill and Ted, Bogus Journey. Like, you were just at the time in 89, you were like, man, these guys are awesome. Like, we got to hear the greatest song in the world. Let's go. And then Bogus Journey happened. So thankfully, Face the Music righted all the wrongs.
Did it for you?
How
that
dare
one,
you?
I never it saw did. That one.
Yeah, Face the Music, I thought was really good to make it a full loop trilogy.
Oh, yeah. Face the Music was great. I don't know how you do not like Bogus Journey, though.
It's, I mean, if you take death out of the movie, and it's a horrible movie. Death is the thing that saves the movie and makes it watchable.
Hmm. I think you guys are about to fight, and I kind of wish you would.
I
lather up in butter first.
Why butter?
I don't know, because I'm hungry.
It never comes off your body.
What?
Wash your hands and it's still there.
You're like, Troy is going to get so many more pimples on his on his ass.
Yeah. So I don't mild. Need that. On Stranger Tides, Pirates of the Caribbean, like the trilogy was done. Didn't need any more.
I don't, man. I can't join you on that one. As much as I don't like the third movie, I really enjoy Johnny Depp's Jack Sparrow. And the fourth and fifth one, I really like both those movies. I don't care what anyone says. Even though the fifth one isn't really a Jack Sparrow movie, it's just a Pirates movie.
Right.
But it rights the wrong of the third movie, so I kind of...
Major League 2. Like, Major League like ended on such a high note, you're like, okay, are they going to go to the series? Are they going to take it all? Like, we got to keep this team together, and then back to the minors, and isn't I was like,
they,
what?
They replaced Wesley Snipes with Omar Epps.
Yep.
Yep.
What?
Yep.
Who made that call? No offense.
Apparently, I would probably say Wesley Snipes did.
Probably, but I'm sorry, just get a new character. Don't try to have him play. Omar Epps just does not. He cannot match the same energy. It's kind of like Jason Patrick. He cannot match the energy of Wesley Snipes. He just cannot do it.
Right.
Epps is a great actor, and he does this thing in his wheelhouse. But he's not Wesley Snipes.
Juice. Attitude. Oh man, Juice is a great movie.
It is a great movie.
It's like saying, let's do White Man Can't Jump again, but put Omar Epps in there instead.
No. Or that whatever that recent one was. God, that was not good. By the way, I tried to watch that remake that just came on Hulu. White Man Can't Jump. I couldn't get that far. That's such
how do you
a
make
great
that? Movie. How did they make it cleaner than the movie? Is that what they did?
No, it's just updated.
Just so not needed.
Just none of the charisma of the first two. Sorry, Woody Harrelson is a very underappreciated actor, like charismatic actor. I feel like he's never really been, even though people like him, people like him in movies. I don't know if he's ever really gotten the appreciation he deserves for how well he balances another actor, and he and Wesley Snipes together are like magic. Because Wesley Snipes is, I've long said, is one of the most underrated actors still working. Because he deserves such a better career. I don't care what his ego's like. A lot of actors have egos. He was a fantastic actor and a great action star.
Yeah, I mean, he's won a couple SAG awards and he won an Emmy.
What was the other movie the two of them was in together? Was that Money Train?
Money Train. Jennifer Lopez, man.
Yep,
she's in it too. Yep. The best
talk
she's
about
ever
a charm
been.
Bomb right there, man.
Oh God, you ain't kidding. She was a Money Train. She was, I mean, you couldn't help but fall in love with her. Could not help it. All right, so let's talk about movies you wish were just the very first film. And you didn't need any more beyond that. Whether it's because of what we saw or you're just happier with the first one, and why? Why, more importantly?
I'll just go with the obvious one, and that's the Lego movie.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, we didn't need
the Lego movie. The first one is so good. Like, the whole way it resolves itself.
Everything is from.
The second one is just, oh, because we made so much money on the first one, we're going to make the second one. And the second one just is not as heartwarming. It's not as funny. It's not, it's just too much Will Ferrell.
God. Is he Will Ferrell? Can we agree? Will Ferrell's just gone full Will Ferrell at this point, right? Like, he's just not as magical as he used to be. I don't care that he was in the Barbie movie. That's not why the Barbie movie is making $1 billion.
If there was a continuum, right, and Will Ferrell is on one side and Nicolas Cage is on the other side, they're like the same person, but Will Ferrell isn't funny and Nick Cage is awesome. But they're just like, they're like in everything and they do everything and it just, they don't need to.
You know what's wild is for once, I totally understand what you're saying.
I that is wild because I have no idea what the fuck he just said.
Are you kidding me? He's basically saying actors that are basically similar in their roles across the board. And Nick Cage is, you know, usually that manic, crazy, but Will Ferrell isn't fun to watch anymore. And Nicolas Cage remains fun to watch. Is that essentially not what you said?
Yeah.
See?
Well, see, it made more sense the way you said it. The way he said it
speak
was like
Troy, man.
Right. Like the way he was like, if you put the two of them on a pendulum and you sit there and set the pendulum on its axis and then tilt the axis by 54 degrees, these two actors are the same. I'm like, what the fuck just happened, Troy?
First of all, it's axis, not access. That's the most important part.
And if there was a pendulum and Will Ferrell is on one end of the pendulum and then Nicolas Cage was on the other and Nicolas Cage comes swinging in, Will Ferrell doesn't move. Nicolas Cage just bounces right back because he's that awesome.
But is that a pendulum? Because that doesn't sound like a pendulum.
John, I understood completely. I think this one's on you.
All right. For those who agree with Troy can comment on this later.
I understood.
It was freaking Superman, for Christ's sake.
Speaking of Will Ferrell, Anchorman 2, that's a prime example. Oh, there's like a trilogy of shitty sequels, like Dumb and Dumber 2, Zoolander 2, and Anchorman 2. None of those need to exist.
Is there a second Cable Guy as well?
There's not a Cable Guy 2, is there?
No, he's not in Cable Guy. You're now conflating
Jim Carrey.
Will Ferrell with Jim Carrey.
No, I was just wondering if there was a Cable Guy 2.
I don't think
so. It seems like something that was...
There's an Ace Ventura 2, but you're not taking that one away from me. I still enjoy it.
No, that one's good. I like both of those movies. The Godfather 2? Totally
Bumblebee Tuna?
Godfather 2 did not need to happen.
I'm with you. Most of the world will not be with you on that one. I'm with you.
The Ring 2 absolutely was not needed. They solved the mystery. They knew who the person was. Like the first Ring is phenomenal by itself. Even Ringu, the original, is even really good.
Ends perfect, too. Ends perfect.
The whole 10 yards, what the actual...
Yeah, that was wildly unnecessary.
Why did they make a sequel to that? That's a movie that
never...
The first
one made so much money.
Yeah, but it really wasn't a massive... I think if you go look it up, I think it was like $57 million or something around that number. It wasn't massive.
Yeah, it became like a cult hit after the fact. Like, Whole Nine Yards was just like... Oh, it's Bruce Willis. Oh, it's Amanda Pete. Oh, okay. Let's watch this. And then people picked it up. And then they were like, as it started picking up steam, then it became like, hey, let's make another one.
Sure.
No, thank you. And Caddyshack 2. Hell no.
Oh, God. Oh,
hell no.
Blues Brothers 2.
Hell no.
I actually like Caddyshack 2.
What?
Yeah, I kind of like it.
Did you see it? Are you sure you didn't?
Caddyshack 2 that you liked it because the movie itself is bad.
Are you sure you didn't just watch Caddyshack 1 twice back to back?
You never really can tell with me, but I actually put it on maybe a month ago. I put it back on just to sit there and watch it.
You did not watch Caddyshack 2 a month ago. Is this a true story?
This is a true story.
Okay. There's no one that is sitting there going like, I'm bored today. Let's put on Caddyshack 2.
All right. So let me go ahead and go find my Max history because I know I watched on Max.
Did you watch Nothing But Trouble as well? Just to watch some really bad 80s
movies?
Nothing But Trouble is a great movie.
You did not.
I did too.
I'm with John on that one. Nothing But Trouble is a great movie.
I totally did. It was the same goddamn day.
That's one way I could see it being recommended after Caddyshack 2.
I want a screenshot of the Max history posted in the group.
Hold on a second. I'm going to see if there's such a
poster,
thing.
Social media poster didn't happen.
That's funny. Any other ones, Troy? Sorry, I didn't
mean to cut you off. No, that's all I got.
I would throw in Child's Play 2 because I loved the first one. But
good one.
Even though I know a lot of people love the Chucky series, and everything, I can't buy any movies after the first one. Because it's just annoying to me that people don't kill this doll. At some point, kick the fucker, burn him, whatever, throw him out a window, whatever you got to do. There's no reason why anyone should be surprised that this thing is coming to life at this point. So that's one of them. Independence Day 2 without Will Smith, worst idea ever. Just absolute abysmal idea. There's nothing about that was exciting. I don't care if Bill Pullman's in it or not. Will Smith not being an Independence Day sequel made no sense to me at all.
Yeah, but his son was, or the kid playing his son was.
It just did not work. It was dumb. Didn't have even a fourth of the charisma of Will Smith. And Disney is doing it everywhere, but Hocus Pocus 2, Disenchanted, like these sequels that nobody, I mean, I guess Hocus Pocus 2, some people wanted, but.
Book of Boba Fett.
That's not a sequel. That's a TV show.
I just want to shit on it.
Yeah, they just do a lot of these sequels to things just to make money, and it just doesn't work for me.
For me, my list is pretty easy. Blade Runner. We could have just stopped with the Blade Runner movie.
Hang on now.
Oh, hang on.
A lot of people love that new Blade Runner. I think, Troy, you might be one of them. I don't remember if you...
I don't necessarily love Blade Runner, period, but both of those movies together do make a pretty compelling... I guess, I don't know, maybe Blade Runner 1 and Blade Runner 2 make me feel like Dune 1 and Dune 2, where it's like, I understand the significance of these two movies, and I understand the closeness to the material and everything. They're not going to like get me up in the morning, but they're both really good movies.
All right, slow down. Okay, Blade Runner 2049 is great because the goose is in it, and then Ana de Armas is in it, and then that's about it. The rest of that movie is...
That's true. I don't like that movie at all. but I will honestly say I didn't like the first Blade Runner. It's just not for me, so that's why I wasn't going to shit on it. Other people obviously love it.
You know, the story is probably great. The production of it annoyed the crap out of me just because of the heavy use of sound and the soundtrack. And what they did to create tension or whatever they were trying to create or make this grandiose feel to it was just way overdone. And so the production is really where it ends with me. The Blair Witch Project is another one where we could have just stopped at the first one and left it alone because we didn't need to have a sequel or even a series of sequels for that story. I think it was more powerful just to have the one movie.
I agree. It was kind of weird how they made the second one a real movie.
Yes.
I mean, I kind of like it to a degree that they went that route, but on the same token, just leave it alone.
Right. They could have just left it alone. First of all, The Blair Witch Project is one of those movies you can't watch twice. I mean, you could try, but
I disagree with that. I disagree with that completely.
Well,
I've seen it like 5 times. So
have you?
Yeah. And I enjoy it every time. It's, man, the last scene still gets me to this day.
Well, maybe I should give it a shot because I think I tried watching it a second time, or maybe I just wasn't interested in watching a second one. But it's not to say it's not a good movie. That's just, it tells me that I got everything I needed out of the first watching of it. And I still think it's a great movie for what it is. Independence Day, obvious reasons, is on my list. Dumb and Dumber. Should have just stopped at Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah. I just talked about that one.
Well, I'm also repeating it.
Okay. Well, I agree.
So there.
I agree. Feels like you weren't listening at all. That's what it feels like.
I was too busy probably looking up my HBO Max history to see if I can find
Caddyshack 2.
Caddyshack 2, and then Nothing But Trouble.
And then did you go like Spies Like Us? You just did the whole 80s Dan Aykroyd, Chevy Chase mix.
I didn't go down Spies Like Us. That would have probably absolved me of any crime I might have committed by watching Caddyshack and then. Caddyshack 2 and then Nothing But Trouble to go to Spies Like Us to really absolve me of all the crimes I just committed by doing that. But no, I didn't do
the
that.
The crime is that if you would have gone to Spies Like Us and not seen Fletch, then you would have had a real issue.
But Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase aren't in there in Fletch together.
No, but Chevy Chase is.
You know, I have weird off topic, but I have I had a friend who was very religious, and he used to make the joke that, you know how you know there's a God? Dan Aykroyd married Donna Dixon.
Yes.
Because the only way that happens is if you pray every day for years.
Mm-hmm.
It made me laugh.
But now they're separated, so it makes all the sense in the world.
You know what? Don't ruin a good thought, okay? Don't ruin it. Just let me roll with it, man. Let me have it. Anything else, or you want me to go to what listener comments were?
Let's go to listener comments, see what they had to say.
Okay. Josh Steinman has a perfect example. The Hangover.
Yeah, I could have seen that being stopped at the first movie and not needed the rinse and repeat of the three movies, but it also gave us the joy of what is Bradley Cooper now.
I think we had Bradley Cooper after the first movie.
Maybe you're right.
Yeah. Michael Weinrich says Avatar, but he also says, come to think of it, we didn't need the first one either. Feels like you're just not an Avatar fan because those movies are making bank.
Yeah, those movies are making bank. However, I mostly agree with him because I don't understand. I watched both movies. I don't understand why everyone loves those movies so much because I don't get anything out of it.
Sure. Andreas Grihalsi says Highlander and Scream.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Yep. Highlander's a great one. That should have just stopped at one.
And Jaws. He's got three of them. Jaws, Highlander, and Scream.
I know I'm in the minority of this, but I will say that Jaws after Jaws 3 should have been... Jaws 3 should have been the end of the story.
So you're a big fan of Jaws 3D?
I am.
Did you see it in 3D?
No, I did.
I did. It was ridiculous, but also quite enjoyable.
Yeah. And I love that.
If you watch it now and you know that it was shot in 3D and you just see the shark, like, I don't know, where he's supposed to be swimming at you, but it just looks like he's swimming still.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty wild to watch it on TV.
It is pretty wild. It also has this, you know, Dennis Quaid.
I know. The only reason that I watched it more than once, honestly.
Right.
I love the Quaid. Becky Phillips, Underworld. I don't know if I ever saw any of the sequels, if I'll be perfectly honest. I saw the first one, and I'm like, I'm good.
I saw the sequels, and I'm going to agree with her. Yeah, I'm going to agree with her.
Jennifer Miller. These are interesting ones. Basic Instinct, RoboCop, Wall Street. I never saw the Basic Instinct sequel, so I can't.
I don't really think I did either.
Yeah. RoboCop, I agree. Never. They've remade it. They've done sequel. No one's ever come close to that first movie. No one. So
well, the first two were great.
I don't think the second one's that great, but I mean, if you feel differently, then so be it.
I enjoy the second one. The third one, when they lose Peter Weller, just doesn't make sense anymore.
No, it doesn't. I think they're making a video game with his voice back in it, though.
That's cool.
Yeah. Jason West, Wrong Turn, specifically. I actually think Wrong Turn 2 is not a bad movie, but I agree. That first one is a really good horror flick, and they should have just left it alone. There's some interesting ones in here. Mike Weinrich also said, I was going to say Breakin', but then we would lose the running joke whenever we hear a movie that is getting a sequel that shouldn't get one, like Speed 2, Electric Boogaloo, The Matrix 2, Electric Boogaloo, etc. That's a good point.
That is a very good point. So thank God we have Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo, which I actually kind of like.
Kristen Mackey, Exorcist, very quickly comes to mind. Hmm.
Yeah.
Exorcist 3 is actually a very good sequel.
I do love Exorcist 3. That's the one with George C. Scott.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah.
It's got Patton in it.
The second one, like, I know it's related, but it almost feels like the difference between Halloween 2 and Halloween 3.
Sure. I could see that. Yep.
Yeah.
I can see that. I have a longstanding debate on Halloween 3. I think Halloween 3 is an excellent movie on its own. And I had this debate with somebody who said, no, it's a terrible movie. It's a terrible sequel, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, is it terrible? Because everyone still knows that theme song. So in my mind, if you still know that jingle, it can't be as terrible as you think it is.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree. I'm going to agree. I think Halloween 3 is a great movie by itself, but it should have had some other name to it, and it should have been completely removed from the idea of Halloween because I don't know what the kind of story they're trying to tell with that, with like combining it into the whole series of Michael Myers. It's like Halloween is Michael Myers' show, so I don't understand why we're doing something different for the third movie like this.
The idea was John Carpenter wanted to create something so that every subsequent movie would be its own, like an anthology of sorts. It would get away from Michael Myers, and it would be an anthology of different Halloween stories, and it just didn't work.
Which is why it should have been called like Halloween : versus Halloween 3. And
yeah.
I think that probably would have made it stick more.
Probably.
But I agree. Like, if you take that out by itself, standalone, it's a great movie standalone.
Happy, happy Halloween, 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 happy, happy Halloween.
Silver, I will sing it all day long. Thank you.
Eight more days till Halloween. Halloween, Halloween. Eight more days to Halloween. Silver Shamrock. See? People know it. People know it. And still a better Michael Myers movie than Halloween Ends. So there's that.
Yeah. Tom Atkins is the star of that one. And I think he was great in the 80s for whatever it is he showed up for.
Literally, I think Halloween 3 and then just randomly. I think The Howling, wasn't he in The Howling?
He was in The Howling. He was in Night of the Creeps.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. He was
you know, I loved his character in Night of the Creeps because he's, and which I just watched again. He's doing.
You watch all this, but you can't watch anything new. I don't understand you.
I just talked about Silo, Hijack, the new Insidious movie. All right. I did a whole bunch of new stuff.
You know what? I stand corrected to a degree. You're just not watching all the good new stuff, like Ted Lasso.
He's been in a lot of stuff, but Night of the Creeps, I loved his character because whenever he answered the phone.
It's not the Atkins show. It's really not.
Right, but I was trying to
get what else he did.
Okay. But I loved it when he's answering the phone. Every time he answers the phone, thrill me. And that's Fred Decker movie.
I don't know what's happening. You know what? I think that's it for this episode. We're done. I got nothing else to talk about. Is there anything else you guys want to mention about sequels we didn't need? Anything?
Nope. Otherwise, we'd be talking about a sequel because the show's over.
He was in Blind Justice.
Jesus Christ.
The Equalizer.
I want to slap you with a rubber glove, theater style. Theater style. Thanks, everybody, for listening. That's it. Remember, everything's at thehollywoodoutsider.com. Subscribe. Review us on your favorite podcast app. We're out of here. Then remember, the next time you head to a theater or sit comfortably on your couch buying popcorn. Or buy popcorn. I don't even know what the tagline is anymore. God damn it.
Drive angry. My bloody Valentine.